Call Registration, Legislation, and Rules Committee to order. Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act prohibits the Board of Technical Registration from discriminating on the basis. I don't need to do that.
No, no.
I don't know why I was reading that. I'm off my A-game today. I haven't done this in a while.
I know.
All right. I've called to order. Roll call, please.
Leroy Brady.
Here.
Jason Poos.
Here.
William Greenslade.
Here.
Robert Stanley. Edward Marley.
Here.
Ronald Starling. We have a quorum.
Thank you. Call to the public. This is part I do need to read. Pursuant to ARS 38431.01H, the committee members are not allowed to discuss or take action on matters raised during an open call to the public unless the matters are properly noticed for discussion and action. However, members may ask staff to review a matter or may ask that a matter be placed on a future agenda. Is there anyone here to address the public? Mr. Barrett.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Have a seat, and if you could state your name for the record, please.
Yes. I am Dr. Wiley Barrett. I am the interim program chair for the Delhi Webb School of Construction at ASU. And I have an interest in reviewing rules related to the graduates of our program, which is a construction management program, becoming registrants. Okay. And I've had a meeting with Melissa and staff. There's some work that they need me to do, some research that I failed to do, that I owe them still. But I would just like to open a dialogue to look at ways to help make that possible for construction management program, recognizing that our program is accredited by the ACCE, the American Council of Construction Educators, not ABET. And the laws and the rules clearly identify ABET accredited programs, and degrees obtained through ABET accredited programs are recognized. There is language in the rules that recognize other than ABET, and there are some challenges in practice. I've got a person who worked for me in a previous career when I was a city engineer for the city of Phoenix, construction management graduate from ASU, in the process now of trying to become accredited, but is being told that her non-ABET accredited degree doesn't provide the 48 months of educational experience required, and she's being made to serve more time of professional experience. So I'd just like to open the dialogue, see that we could address how ACCE accreditation could perhaps be fit within the rules, and help facilitate graduates of our program becoming registrants here in the state of Arizona.
Okay.
And that's about all I wanted to say today, Mr. Chairman. Just kind of get that on the record and start that dialogue.
Okay, thank you. And I believe what part of your homework is to give us the curriculum?
Yes, to provide a curriculum map for our program. That's somewhat in flux right now. We're in the process of revising it.
Okay.
So I'll be bringing that newest accreditation or curriculum map to share with staff. And then another piece of homework that I haven't completed was to get some input from other states on how they deal with construction managers. We've worked with employers to recognize that construction managers can sometimes fit their job descriptions. One comes to mind immediately, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. In the past, it's always been engineering degree. And now they've added their language that's engineering degree or related field. We feel that our construction management is a related field, but employers, owners, like the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers frequently require PEs to elevate to levels of responsibility, and we would like our graduates to be able to do that. We feel that they have the education, the background, the experience to fill those positions. What's holding them back is that they have challenges getting that PE to be able to compete at that next level. So.
One thing that would be helpful, and I don't know if ABET has this, I shared with you, Patty, the NAB, the architect side of it, NAB accreditation matrix that shows so many semester hours in these separate categories. And if ABET has a similar
I have that
chart,
yeah.
I think what would be helpful is if you could develop a matrix that would kind of show, okay, here's what ABET is, and here's what you feel are the equivalencies, then as it comes to staff and then eventually to the board for review, we can get an understanding of how how it is parallel, maybe where there are some deficiencies and where folks might need to make some things up. So
that's very possible. Mr. Chairman, what I would maybe share, recently the accreditation process has changed both ABET and ACCE to be more outcomes-based, as opposed to just counting, yes, we offer this class, plus right. this class. It's evaluating students on their way out the door, do they have the skills? Not did they take this class, because right. you can take every okay. class in the world, if the knowledge transfer isn't taking place, students don't come out with the requisite skills. You know, if I may, your registration process is very much an inputs-based process, and I would encourage or suggest that maybe we look to more of an outcomes-based process in the registration process as well. Why are we so concerned about the degrees that people have when they come in to take the EIT? If they can pass the EIT, that should be the major of whether or not they're qualified to participate in the industry. Whether their degree is from an ABET accredited university, an ACCE accredited university, the fact that they can take and pass the exam should be the measure, not necessarily check the box, you took this class, this class, this class, this class.
Sure.
So that's the way education is moving. I would suggest right. that maybe we look at that as well at, yeah. At the state registration okay. process.
I think that's a great suggestion. Mm-hmm. So we're,
thank you.
As long as we're reviewing our rules package, we can roll that into it. NCARB's doing the same thing. I mean, mm-hmm. the
exactly.
examination is certainly much more outcomes-based. The AXP now is more outcomes-based. It's not solely based on seat time. So I think that's a good direction to head. So really appreciate your comments on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Adoption of minutes. Approve, modify, and or reject the October 4th, 2016 LNR committee minutes. There's an updated minutes on your desk. The only change that was made is the footer, I believe, had the wrong date on it. Is that right, Kurt?
Yes, it said agenda as well as minutes.
Oh, okay. So we updated the footer. Otherwise, I didn't see anything in the minutes.
I move that we accept the minutes.
We have a motion to accept. Do I have a second?
Second.
And a motion and second. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Agenda 5A, review, discussion, and possible action on review of Title IV, Chapter 30, Board Rules for Possible Revision in 2017.
So this was light reading, yes?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Always. I love reading the rules. That's what got me into this years ago.
I know. So this was homework that I gave myself because my deputy director is intent on revising rules before the end of the year.
Look at me.
And it's not a bad idea.
No.
I mean, these obviously are pretty archaic. We've seen a lot of changes in practice, real-world experiences that have come before the board that really have given, I think, all of us pause recently as to what we might like to amend and what we probably should amend and what we should create in terms of, like, alarm rules. Rules related to that practice.
That's what I've been harassing.
Yeah, the alarms rules. And obviously the home inspectors have been busy. They want to revise the rules that govern their practice. We have lost some programs as a result of legislation that passed last session, the drug lab program, assayer in training, landscape architect in training, architect in training, those designations that were repealed by the legislature last session. Fees have changed. Obviously, Mr. Wiley from ASU has a valid argument. We should look at Rule 208 to determine, you know, who and what we're giving credit for towards registration. I think that will be the hotbed of discussion at the legislature this year, how strict we are about getting people registered. We heard the governor's address last well, last afternoon. We're a swamp now, not a dark corner. And from what I've heard in conversations with several reporters is that there will be legislation that softens registration requirements. They're not looking to deregulate necessarily this session, although we'll see some of that, I'm convinced. But if we can be more outcomes-based, perhaps we can demonstrate that we are not a bar to people getting registered, that we are looking to modify standards without diminishing public protection.
Right.
So with that in mind, that's why I just dove right in and started crossing things off and underlining things. And so I don't know if you want to take it one rule at a time
some of them I think we can kind of maybe go a page at a time and just kind of look at things. At least that's my thought. I don't know what you guys think, but it's kind of like some of them, I mean, like the first page, we're striking assaying.
There is something I have to dive in with that Melissa and I have been debating.
Okay.
last year the DEQ agreed to take the drug lab program,
right.
And in that legislation, one of the things we did is we kept our rules on the books because it will take them a while to promulgate their own rules.
Right.
So in order for them to start the program and keep it going and clean up these properties, they need our rules to stay in place for now.
So they can refer to our rules
right.
as part of their...
And it actually says that right in the bill.
Okay.
It takes a while to do rules. They really only got this program, last spring.
Right.
So, there's a strikeout for the on-site supervisors and the workers and all and the firms in here, and we need to keep it. And Melissa doesn't agree, but we need to keep it. In good faith, we said to them, if you take this program, we'll keep these rules in place while you create yours.
Right.
What I would suggest is we send a letter to the director and say it's our intent to repeal these rules January 1st, 2018. If you're going to run into a problem, let us know.
I think that's...
Yeah.
That's
I'd like her solution.
I like
really
that.
Do. And that way...
There's really no harm in leaving it in there for the time being, but if we can let... because this is going to... It's going to take a year to get all this through anyway and get through GERD and all that stuff. So, or longer. So let's plan to pull all of the drug lab language.
It was so sad.
The caveat that we could leave
it, though.
We'll set it aside for now and then do it. It'll be easy to repeal once it's time.
Yeah, because it's something that I don't see Dirk having any issue with or anything like that. But, yeah, because I had circled it because I was like, why is it still in here? I'd forgotten about the legislation.
Yeah, and I did confirm with them that they do need those rules in order to go in and clean. And they are cleaning up the properties, and they're using those rules. But they need the description of the firm and the people performing the work.
Yeah.
In law to continue. So I think we just let them know that it's a year, and then they may be all done in a year because there was only so much money in that fund, and they may just say we're done with it.
And it may be that some of the properties on the list don't exist anymore or don't need to be cleaned up anymore. So I like the idea.
There aren't any more to be added?
No,
the problem is the technology, if you will, from what we had heard from some of the experts, was they're making the stuff in RVs and all kinds of stuff, and they're not cooking it anymore. They're making it in,
two liter
soda bottles. And
what happened when we transferred the law, it lets DEQ clean up any drug property. Yeah, that was the other thing. It was like narrow to what it focused on when the problems become broader and there's new drugs and there's new manufacturing. So when this law moved to DEQ, it actually broadened what they can do to clean up properties as well.
And DEQ already had pretty broad cleanup authority. So this just gave them the money that we had been collecting for the past couple of years, which was about $255,000, that came to us via a criminal assessment imposed on defendants convicted of drug crimes when they were sentenced in the superior courts around the state. But the law didn't give us the authority to do anything with the money, so we were just collecting it. And last legislative session, what we proposed was getting rid of the program, since there were only 38 properties, I think, on the list, about that were meth lab related, giving the money to DEQ and along with that the authority for them to go clean up those properties with that money, and if they could do it for less than $255,000, that's great for them. They got to keep the remainder to put towards whatever other remediation programs they had in place. So for the state, it was really a big win. For the board, it was a win. I was really proud of it, honestly, because it was doing the right thing with the money.
Yeah.
And it was a program that was or had cost the board a lot of money, and we had seen no benefit for, very little benefit for, actually. And meth was being made differently, so properties weren't being contaminated like they were from meth, you know. So
are you suggesting then that we don't go through these rules now? Because we put them all on the side and wait? Or do you
No. Go ahead and go through them. Well, we can go ahead and ask the governor. We have to go through this process of asking the governor for a waiver anyway. Just for that particular group, you know, we'll ask for the waiver so when the time comes we can just go ahead and do it. But, you know, that little group will kind of set aside until we're ready to do the full repeal. But we'll go ahead and get your approval and the waiver. Just, you know, FYI, that little group won't happen right away with the rest of them.
Well, it'll probably all take forever, so. But I like the idea of communicating with DEQ and giving them a time frame.
All right. So back on page one, I actually had a question. Under paragraph 12, right at the very bottom, good moral mm-hmm. character and repute. So mm-hmm. we're stripping out the class of the felony. So I don't know what that means because I'm an architect, not a lawyer.
Class one felony is murder. And okay. We don't often see a lot of architects or geologists murdering.
Cases, that was one of the first cases I ever sat over when I came on the board.
And that'll probably be the only one that we ever get was that architect, yeah. And that was vehicular homicide.
Figured it was an architect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was.
It was actually second degree murder.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was.
Yeah. So that's what a class one felony is, basically. And, you know, we don't see that often, but we do see other felonies, so I thought just to make the rules section a little more generic.
Mm-hmm. So the question that I have is, I like the idea, okay, so we put all the felonies under subparagraph A, and we talk, and so we're dealing with misdemeanor offenses under paragraph B. Should we, there's two questions I have. It says, if the offense has a reasonable relationship to the functions of employment or category for which registration, certification, or designation is sought. So we say reasonable relationship, and in the opinion is a bad word, but in the opinion of the board. In other words, should we clarify, in other words, who's going to establish that reasonable relationship?
That's a good question, and if you look...
And I don't know if it's further clarified down somewhere else.
You know, there's really similar language under paragraph 16 on the second page, and actually I crossed it off on page 2.
16, there we go.
Under other misconduct. I don't know if we want to cross it off or if you want to keep it and just make it more...
I was going to say, that's almost duplicate.
Yeah.
I would almost say under 16, you get rid of A and B because they're referenced up above in 12.
Right.
A question.
But also, so is, sorry, so I don't forget, also so is C, 12C is also referenced under 16C. Let's make your head spin.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Leroy, go ahead.
I have a question. Felony is defined in Arizona, and there are certain things that fall into felony classes. Mm-hmm. Other states, they may just be misdemeanors.
Yeah, other states often do categorize things differently than we do in Arizona. So, like, what's a felony in Arizona might be called a class... two offense in another state. it makes it harder for us when we look at criminal history to determine whether what was deemed a Class A or a Class 2 or whatever in another state is equivalent to our...
Do we need to say a felony or other thing?
Or equivalent offense.
Equivalent offense. And
something, so we pull in those other ones. What I'm trying to do is broaden the ability of the board to have some discretion in how they determine that this is applicable. And so by saying felony or equivalent offense, allow us to do that. I'm actually seeing quite a few repeats between 16 and 12.
Yeah.
Because you've got the professional license suspended or revoked. You've got incarcerated in a penal institution.
Right.
So A, B, C, and D under 16.
You want to just take out?
I think should all be taken out.
Do you like the language in 12 regarding the misdemeanor if the offense has that reasonable relationship to the functions of employment?
I like having that in there.
Okay.
Because we have dealt with that. Because we've looked at, what it's enabled us, this board to do is impose additional requirements on disciplinary action. Someone's a chronic DUI, we've been able to say, you need to show us that you've gotten into some kind of a rehab program and give us monthly updates, 6-month updates or whatever, and show completion of this program as a condition of, you know, of not getting your license suspended, revoked, whatever.
Cool.
So I think...
Hello.
Morning.
So you like that? Okay.
You might actually sit closer.
I don't... People can sit wherever they want today. This is pretty...
relaxed?
Pretty relaxed, yes.
Can I sit at the table?
Sure. Can you introduce yourself?
I am Michelle Guy with Westwood Engineering.
Okay.
And I'm... inactive land surveyor, and I represent APLS on the L&R committee.
Okay, great. Welcome. Come on up,
then
Tina.
Then Tina can come up,
too. Yeah, come on up to the table, Tina.
Or relegated to the back, Tina.
Always, that's my seat, though.
So, okay. A couple of things I think, and the rest of the group can chime in, I think we should further clarify that it's the board that would make the determination about the reasonable relationship to the function of employment.
Okay.
And my concern is under 12, when it says for which registration, certification, or designation is sought, it almost sounds like this is applicable only to an initial, it might be interpreted as only applicable to an initial application rather than also a renewal.
Okay.
And so if there's a way to put some language in there so that we make sure that it's clear that it's... Because we ask the same questions for renewals and for initial applications.
I like that.
Okay.
I don't want someone to come to us and say, you don't have grounds to ask me that question because your Rule 12B only applies to initial applications.
Well, and then should we also say for disciplinary actions as well that... this good moral character and repute.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think the more we can kind of broaden the scope of this a little bit to make sure that we're covered.
One of the questions I had on this was whether the misdemeanor, well, actually, maybe we should discuss both the felony and misdemeanor ones, is whether there's a year limit, some years, like in some of the areas we say within the last 5 years and so forth.
Right.
Should that be that similar wording to me in here.
Probably okay. Well, first of all, we only ask it for renewals. It's basically a 3-year period.
Right.
Because once they've reported it, and once we've renewed them and deemed that it's not reasonably related to the practice, then the next time they renew, they don't have to report it.
Yep.
They're not bound to report it. It's just because the renewal application says, within the last renewal period, have you been convicted of? And so, but felonies, it's probably kind of something we want to know almost, I don't know if we wanted to, in perpetuity, though. We dealt with that alarm agent several years ago when we had the really restrictive ones, and we had to deny this gentleman's application because 30 years ago he was convicted of a vehicular manslaughter, and it was on the list as a felony crime, and we couldn't grant. Although the guy lived a stellar life after that. He served prison time. I think he served 14 years in prison. He had security clearances with two federal agencies and all kind. The guy was who you would want as an alarm agent. We couldn't grant his license. And so I want to be careful that we don't make the felony one in perpetuity too. So maybe it's the same. Is it the same on the renewal? I mean, the way I read this is if you have been convicted of a felony under that statute, you lack good moral character and repute and can't be registered.
Well,
same for misdemeanor under this day, under B.
But it says has a reasonable relationship. Right. So, I mean, we do soften that language a little bit, and that's why I'm asking for some additional clarification to put, board determination in there and things like that. But the felony, you're convicted of a felony,
legally,
you're out.
Legally, once you're a felon, your civil rights are removed, so you can't vote, you can't carry a weapon, there are various other things. Impliedly, in the law, a felony conviction is an automatic determination that you lack good moral character. So, for instance, if you're convicted of a felony, the law allows the judge not only to sentence you for the crime, but also to remove any registrations that you hold in the state because you impliedly don't have the good character to maintain them. So I used to do that periodically when I was an AG. If the case was, if there was a case in criminal court that involved one of our licensees from whatever board it was I was representing, I would write to the court and say, while you're sentencing, please remove the registration. And there's a law that allows for that. Now, it's in the judge's discretion, but it can happen that way. Because
that wouldn't precede our board from taking action and removing their registration.
Right. We wouldn't, as a board, have to do that. Because the law has that implied definition of good moral character. So
should we, let's say somebody is convicted of a felony, they serve their time, they get their civil rights restored, should we build something like, some language like that into it? Because this right now, the way it reads, I agree with Bill, it's in perpetuity. 50 years ago, somebody, was convicted of manslaughter, and they served 10 years in prison, and now they want to, they want to get licensed, and they can't. Based on this rule, because it just says you've been convicted of felony, you're no longer in good moral character and repute.
On the other hand, though, the board always has discretion to issue a license if they feel the applicant has met the burden of proof to demonstrate that they are capable and qualified. So this board hasn't dealt with it, but other, especially the healthcare boards, often deal with felons who want to come back and practice dentistry again or whatever the profession they were. And what they do is they make this big presentation to the board with letters of support from the court and the probation officer and their church and their community, and they demonstrate that they went back for refresher training and whatever else that they can to demonstrate that they now do have the moral character, they've been rehabilitated. So boards with similar language haven't felt the need to go back and elaborate in the rule that there will be this rehab.
Yeah, and I don't want to overcomplicate
it. Once their civil rights have been restored?
Yes.
So maybe maybe some language you hear about restoration civil rights.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that would be appropriate.
So that would make it not a blanket condition forever.
I think it just gives us then a little clearer discretion. And I mean, if you read this in the black and white, it just says you've been convicted of a felony. You're not of good moral character. and there's no exit valve there.
That's true.
So.
Okay.
But if
I will.
The rights restored, then maybe let's move on to page 2.
All right.
So I think under paragraph 16, we should clean that up.
Yeah. Do you like keeping E and F? Just make them A and B? Do you want to include anything else?
Well, how about D? I mean, we didn't address the issue of license suspension, and it's not addressed in 12. Or is it?
It is addressed in 12.
On the second page. So I think if it's been addressed up there, then we strip it. I think A, B, C, and D could be taken out.
Okay.
And then
do you still like the definition of project prime professional and the more industry-specific terms we have in here, professional documents? Do we need to add or take anything out of that? And I know on the previous page there's like responsible charge experience.
You know, I think, is that up in the, that's, is that on the previous?
Yeah, page 1. I know Jason had in the past expressed sub-professional experience. Am I speaking out of turn, Jason? Do you like the term sub-professional?
Oh, gosh. You know, there's a place for it. We use it, I think we have 6 months of it we can count. So I like the term. I like having the term in there if that's the question you're asking.
Okay.
I rarely disagree with Jason, but I hate the term. I never use it. I never really apply it to my evaluations of anyone's experience because it just, to me, everything an applicant does is basically, it should be under the direct supervision. You know, and to me it's all professional experience because quite honestly, everybody in my office is training as a professional. And maybe it's because my firm's structured a little differently. I don't have any just people who are purely draftspeople and that's all they do all day and they'll never do anything else and that's their chosen career path. So maybe I'm okay leaving it in there. I'm not arguing against it. I'm just saying.
Do we have some place that we define sub-professional?
Right.
Yeah, this is it right here. Means task work done under direct supervision and not falling within the definition of professional experience. I love when you define a definition with a definition under a term. It's like, oh my goodness.
So then
professional experience is right below.
Yeah.
Professional experience means we're calling substantial technical knowledge, skill, and responsibility. And I think this is where you know, Mr. Barrett from ASU really brings up a good point. This is task-oriented definitions.
Mm-hmm.
And if we really want to start evolving into a mindset of outcome-based evaluation of our candidates, then terms like this begin to kind of take on a lesser and lesser level of importance.
Well, that's why I raise it, because I don't know what you guys do, so I don't know how to change this. If you feel it needs to be changed, this is a good time.
And some of it maybe just comes down to, you know, I'm biasing my opinions with my professional experience a little bit because the way I run my firm is, to me, everything, what we try to drum into our interns, I know it's a bad word, but according to NCARB, but, you know, what we try to really instill in them is that every single thing you do is important, and it adds to the, you know, it's critical to the overall outcome of what we do as architects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we sit down with some folks when we're struggling with folks and have issues and need to kind of counsel them and help them. You know, we tell them, you think about every line you draw because it represents something, and it's a critical part of the architecture that we're ultimately creating. So it's not just a bunch of lines on a computer screen. You know, they eventually have meaning to somebody else, a contractor, an owner, you know, a member of the public. And so, to me, it's more holistic. Compartmentalizing experience like this is just not something we would do.
And then if you look at the specific people they're talking about, Rodman, Chainman, Recorder, it's more surveying.
And so that's why I'm okay leaving it in there. I mean, you know. But
unless you want to add,
no,
you know, trained geologist.
Trained geologist. Trained architect.
Yeah.
But you look at the whole definition of experience, I think that's one that maybe we need to drill a little deeper on, and it may not something we can solve today, but I think if we want to start, like I said, if we want to start evolving toward a more outcomes-based approach to experience, then it's going to take a little time to
I agree. I mean, my feeling is that from the geology perspective, there are people who spend all of their time just sitting on a drill rig. They don't really provide any geologic interpretation of the information that's coming out of the drill rig.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, would be considered sub-professional activity. And there's been one or two times when I was reviewing an application when an applicant, that's essentially what they had done. But I also like the idea where this is going in terms of, if you can pass the fundamentals and if you can pass the professional exam, whether your experience to date is sitting on a drill rig really isn't relevant, because it means that you've educated yourself and you've taken upon yourself to learn what it takes to pass the exams.
Yeah.
So I like the idea of going more towards reliance on the exams and less on prior experience in the application.
Yeah, the only caveat I have there is there's still real value to having some increment of time where you're learning just in the office environment. I'm speaking for architects at this point, right? And in maybe engineers, just because there's aspects of the practice of architecture and engineering that you just don't get in school.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not suggesting by my comments that we ought to eliminate experience.
No, and I didn't take it that way. I'm just saying that I want to make sure that, you know, really what it's all about is it's about a diversity of experience.
In order to make decisions.
In order to make decisions, yeah.
And
judgments. It's a part of the critical thinking process. And
that's
right. It's not, that experience, that diversity of experience isn't necessarily cleanly sliced into four different little categories like we have here.
Yeah.
So that sounds like a better definition of professional experience, almost, to say that professional experience requires a diversity of experience to make good judgments, calling for technical knowledge and skill and responsibility.
Or relying on.
Relying on, yeah.
See, to me, it's all professional experience, and so, you know,
and it's
whether you're being a rodman or a draftsman or whatever, it's just kind of all a part of that compendium of experience that you gather over a 3, 4, 5 year period, 8 year period, whatever it takes.
Yeah, Ed, the problem that we have on the surveying side is we'll have somebody claim 8 years of redundant sub-professional experience, and that comes up occasionally. Probably in the last year I've had, maybe 30% of that. I actually had one applicant submit all sub-professional experience. And it was good experience, it was valuable, but it was redundant, and that's what kind of demarks the value of it.
Mm-hmm.
There are some elementary things that a technician can do that are valuable to professional practice, but if that's all that technician does, they never progress. So that's the value of the surveying evaluation,
sure,
is that because we're so based on experience, we can segregate redundant experience from pertinent and progressive experience.
Well, and I think you know, and I definitely agree with you. Even on the architect side of it, that's really important. And one of, because we don't want somebody that's stuck doing construction documents for 98% of their time duration. But what we've done here is we have the application form for those who don't have a NAB accredited degree has a breakdown of 16 different categories, and we ask them to do, you know, how many months in each of those categories so that we can determine that there's been a diversity of work experience in that five to eight years depending upon their educational status. So we ensure through the application process that they, it's on their certificate of experience forms. And maybe we could develop something like that for each of the disciplines so that we can help kind of take this experience level down to something that's a little more succinct in terms of the diversity of experience. Okay. And it can apply to all the disciplines that we regulate. And that way you still get an assurance that they're not just being a rodman for 4 years and then claiming that all as their experience when they really need, you know, other experience that we would currently classify as professional experience.
Now, I just want to throw a monkey wrench in.
Well, of course.
Just because I'm a devil's advocate at times. Yeah. What happened with the geologists making this trained geology designation in Arizona may be what the legislature has in mind for the other professions this year. I'm not sure, but, you know, it could be that logical progression where now, you know, you can claim you're capable and qualified to practice geology without registration as long as you have a 4-year geology degree and 4 years of experience and no national exams. So do we want to, in our definitions here, anticipate something like that? Or just proceed as if it's going to be, the exams are going to be required, and they are required for people who wish to remain registered geologists or to become a registered geologist. So
I think we need to stick with it.
Okay.
What we're doing, because as I understand the AG opinion, we really have minimal, if any, regulatory authority over the trained category.
Right.
People.
Right.
And so to write something in the rules in anticipation of that, first of all, it scares me.
Yeah.
It's almost like giving up. And it may be building something into our rules that's not enforceable.
Okay. That's valid.
So. And there's one other thing, too. It reinforces our ability to recognize experience without education.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in looking at Mexico, I mean, you graduate as an engineer, you're a PE automatically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there are those that would argue that maybe that's the way we should be.
Well, and NCARB's headed in that direction. Oh. But it's still an 8-year, 7 to 8 year duration.
Yeah.
I think we hear, you know, what is it, whatever they're calling it. I can't think, I just lost it.
AXP?
No, that's no. It's the...
The mutual recognition?
No, it's the one with the colleges where they can do...
Oh, right, the accelerated program.
Yeah, I can't remember
either.
Path to licensure.
Yeah, alternative path to licensure, yeah.
Oh. But you still have to take the exam.
You still have to take the exam, but what it means is in a 7 to 8 year aggregate period, you get your education, your experience, and your examination. It takes no less time, but you're handed your degree, and if you've passed the exam, you're eligible for licensure.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean you're licensed, but you're eligible for licensure.
Yeah.
In jurisdictions that would accept it.
That's right.
And since you're going through the AXP and you're getting the experience and you're getting a NAB accredited degree out of it, Arizona by default would accept someone with an alternative path to licensure.
Okay.
I have my doubts that anyone's really going to be able to do it, considering the average time for somebody to get licensed is well over the 8 years. I think. So shall we move along?
Yes.
So 16, we've talked about the home inspection definitions. Does anybody have any comments on that? You know, I think
they're going to meet next week.
Okay, and they've done a really good job of, this is kind of their baby. And
I have one addition for them that we're going to talk about next week, and which, you know, we can bring back. Is they've created this tool called a report checklist supplement, which I think I included.
Yeah, it's on item number 5.
Yeah, they haven't seen that yet.
I like that. When I was going through this and looking at it, one of the questions I had was, you know, if people do these reports, and is there some sort of format or requirement of something that be in the report? And then I got to this checklist and I thought, well, this is a good idea because it provides mm-hmm. that. So it seemed to make sense to me. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll see how they like it. You know, they have their own standards similar to what the surveyors have. You know, they have their own standards, and so they want their reports to have various things in them, but there's no standard form for a report other than, you know, they have to use, they have to incorporate everything that's in the standards. So this tool that they came up with helps applicants, and we would love it if they used it, and the only way for that to happen is if we put it in the rules. So
yeah, I thought it was a good idea.
Okay, good. And then you can see that they asked that all the rest of these definitions get removed because they felt they were already contained in the standards. So
yeah. I think that's some really good housekeeping.
Yeah, they're trying. And then obviously page 4 or 5 and the top of 6 talks about the drug lab site remediation mm-hmm. definitions, which we'll have to keep.
Jump to fees.
Yeah. And actually, we've already received authority to revise our fee schedule, so it's just in here because I wanted you guys to see what we're talking about.
Yeah. I had a question on A1 and A2. It almost seems like they're backwards. Because you have a computer-generated list for non-commercial purposes is 25 cents a name, but a computer-generated list for registrants for commercial purposes is 2.5 cents per name.
What?
Is that a typo?
I think it should be the other way around.
You have a zero in there?
I think it's
yes, I see that. Okay. Yeah, no, it should be 0.25.
Okay, so they're both 0.25. Okay, and then the minimum fee for commercial versus a maximum fee for non-commercial.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So do you want me to switch them?
No, I think you just need to take the zero.
Oh, yeah. No, okay.
Then we're good. I thought, well, maybe we're just going to give the non-commercial purposes, you know, a little break. Which, you know, is it 25 cents a name or is it 2.5 cents a name?
No, it's 25.
Okay.
Yeah. Some of the commercial purpose ones are really long, so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think the minimum fee is good, and I think, you know, if they really, really want it, they'll be willing to pony it up. So,
what else was? We're making laminated pocket cards available to our other professions, not just for alarms. So,
okay.
You know, if you guys want a laminated card, I mean, we send a PDF. One. Yeah, but if you want a laminated card,
keep it with my badge.
Yep.
Does number 6 need an hourly rate?
Or yeah, you need.
Oh, we could.
Or is it just?
I think
subject?
What we've been doing is depending on who actually is doing the records request. Like if it's Kurt, we take Kurt's hourly salary and mm-hmm. use that. Whereas if it, and I think you're the only one that's you and Travis, right, doing them.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and they should be hourly salary rate plus
overhead. We've had this discussion before. This is where
you could put a range
in there, the business,
so people might know what the range might be.
I would be perfectly happy to take the highest rate and plug that in and use
up
it.
Up to?
Or just say, it's going to be this amount, and whether it's, I don't know what the compensation levels are, but whatever the highest one is, plug that in there. Otherwise, it's just kind of weird. It's like, well, I want the cheaper guy.
Yeah.
You know, that's what you're going to get.
I want the cheaper guy. Okay.
I'm not trying to offend anyone. I'm just saying that's how your customers are going to be when they walk in. Well, I want the $25 an hour guy, not the $30 an hour guy.
That's a good point. You okay.
Know? So just make it 30.
All right. Cool.
Does it normally take more than 1 hour?
Yeah, Kurt. How long does it take you?
The
local exam
record
review.
And that would be
the local
Dolly.
Examination review fee?
It will. Sometimes 4 hours, depending on which exam.
Okay.
Like if they want to come and look at the state-specific surveying, that's a shorter exam than, geological engineering exam. Or they can also...
They can review any of them.
Yeah, any of
NCARB these. Exam.
And NCARB sends people out here, and they pay for their travel and all that. So, yeah, it's pretty pricey.
That was the only one that I saw that had hourly rates.
Cool.
I will never forget, we got a request from a landscape architect to review her exam. And I'm looking at the exam, and it's real similar to one of the highest scoring in the state for that year. And it was marked down as zero. And I called the national people who had, and they said, we don't understand how that could have gotten that mark on it. It turns out she was a daughter of the head of the Maricopa County Flood Control District. And so when we graded the exam, she was right up there at the top.
Mm-hmm.
But
she got a zero.
But she got a zero, and had she not requested that review of her exam, would have been another test year.
Wow. Well, so it can help.
I'm reading this in the light of somebody who doesn't read these rules very often, trying to see where there might be areas of confusion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so under paragraph B, it says, a person paying fee shall remit them in United States dollars in the form of cash, cashier's check, money order, or credit card. We pay renewal fees. My firm does. I do. They're paid with a corporate check.
Okay.
And so now I'm going to have to issue a cashier's check, the way this is worded right now.
Yep. Corporate check. Do you want me to include that?
Well, I don't know that corporate check
just
is
a check.
Just
keep it as check.
Personal/corporate.
How often do you get checks anymore?
We do get non-sufficient fund checks, which is why I put in cashiers.
Yeah.
But we don't get a ton. We do get, from like small businesses, not from...
Yeah, sole proprietorships,
right,
and things like that. It's not going to be a corporate check, and that's why I'm saying a lot of, this is not
corporate
user-friendly.
Or cashier's check. How about that?
But what do you think?
You're excluding a personal check. Is that
yep.
what you're doing?
Yeah. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe
if it isn't
just
a big a deal, I wouldn't change it. I'd just leave it check.
You would?
I mean, how many times has this happened, and how big a deal is it?
Well, and then you just leave. Then you just leave in the non-sufficient funds.
Yeah.
You just leave
okay.
in that text
yeah.
that you struck. And then
is there much of a difference between a cashier's check and a money order?
No.
No.
They're both pretty much the same. Cashier's check, you generally get at a bank. It's drawn right out of your account. A money order, you go, you pay with a credit card, you can get them at Western Union. Leroy likes to go to the title loan places to get them.
Never been in one.
Neither have I.
Then you can take out seven return check fees. You're going to leave it in the...
Yeah.
If it's all related.
Well, but we don't stipulate a dollar amount under B. I think that's why we have seven above.
Oh, I see. Okay, kind of.
Yeah, so that quantifies the amount.
Okay.
Yeah, so I would just leave it as it is.
Add credit card
because that's coming.
Yep. Okay.
All right.
We added in, are we ready for 107?
Yeah, so we can go on to the bottom. Okay. So alarm businesses, we've added that.
And we may, because we've heard that our alarm bill from last year will be run again this year. So they may end up with a 3-year renewal, so I might change the 2 to 3.
Okay.
That was a question I had. I didn't see why it should be different from all the rest.
Nice to keep them on parallel.
So that was because it was in the statute or
yeah.
something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then complaint review, we're going to take out the shall and make it may. It's page 7. May be comprised of one public member and a minimum of four registrants.
Largely because it's been difficult for our enforcement team to find public people to come and sit in on enforcement advisory committee meetings. So that's why we want to change the shall to a may.
May.
I like it.
What else did I? My copy did not come out in red, so.
So G is the next one, that's fine, I think.
Mm-hmm. What about, we struck the, in E, striking the offer the respondent an opportunity to attend an informal conference. Why was that taken?
We struck it because that language already is contained in the Administrative Procedures Act under Title 41. So it's already contained in statute.
So the respondent does have an opportunity.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and if you look down at R43123,
I thought I saw it somewhere else.
So that was,
let's see.
I'm good with page 7.
I just had one question about the meetings. Upon completion of the interview, completion of the meeting, board enforcement shall make a record. Are there minutes in these meetings?
No.
Should there be? Just a question.
Do the investigators keep notes? I mean, a lot of them, I mean, we have seen investigator notes to file and things like that. I just...
You know what comes out of the meetings are those recommended... the chairman writes a recommendation to the board.
That's the, yeah. I think this is, But this is the meeting with board staff, I think. Is that the one you're talking about? So the R43123A?
Yeah.
They meet with board staff, and I think what we're looking at is are there notes taken during...
No, and legally, any kind of... negotiation for a consent agreement is considered confidential, so notes from a meeting like that probably wouldn't be available to the board or the decision maker, like at Office of Administrative Hearings. Mm-hmm. So what would come out is either an agreement to enter into a consent agreement, which the board would see and approve or reject, or a advancement onto the formal hearing.
That's been actually working pretty well, I think. You know, I mean, we get a staff recommendation. We know there's been some negotiations that have gone on, but staff oftentimes, you know, they'll share during the presentation, hey, we tried to get him to agree to this amount. We had to negotiate it down. Mm-hmm. The board always has the discretion to take the number back up, you know, on a fine or something like that. So.
And when they leave the informal compliance meeting, they're going to know what the outcome is, whether it's a settlement or proceeding through to formal hearing.
Proposed outcomes. Just something.
That's why we're doing this. So, because if it isn't clear to you, it won't be clear to the public, and that's our intent. Yeah. You know, to make it more clear.
One of the things I see missing from this, Melissa, is the assessment phase where the investigative staff send out the complaints to a registrant for an assessment to say if a committee is warranted or not, or the formation of a committee meeting is warranted. I don't know if that's just something we do or if that needs to be spelled out. I know that recently I was asked that question by somebody in a public hearing, so I don't know if that's something we need to look at.
Well, you could look back at Rule 120. Subsection A talks about getting, you know, people to comprise the committees, and then the preliminary informal investigation, they can appear before the EAC.
It does say, committee members shall provide technical assistance to board staff in the evaluation and investigation of complaints.
So
I think that's what you're alluding to, Jason. Maybe it needs to be, the wording needs to be tweaked a little bit to make it clearer that, because right now you have there's, for lack of a better way to put it, there's a policy that you send out the evidence packet for a case to an evaluator, and most of the time it's two evaluators, and if they come up with two different determinations, you send it to a third evaluator as a kind of a tiebreaker, if you will, and then it either moves to EAC or it doesn't.
But that's an evaluation, and here you say each committee comprised of one public member and a minimum
four. I think we need to insert
something about
something
the evaluation process. Let me do that. Okay.
Does that help, Jason, and with your concern?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think it does. As I read this, I can see where process would develop, but it's not spelled out.
It's not clear.
I don't know if that's a concern or not. I'm just bringing it up.
That really becomes an A.
Yeah.
But then look at 121. It says, if any information concerning a possible violation of the act obtained by the board, an investigation shall be conducted prior to the initiation of formal proceedings. Investigative reports, EAC recommendations, remain confidential.
It's almost like 120 and 121 need to be worked together. Because they're really both relating to the same. They're both dealing with investigations.
You know, when I was revising these things, it's like you just want to start from scratch. But JERC won't let you. You know, you have to deal with what you've got.
Yeah.
And
well, I think it would make it a lot more clearer if you defined
the
process,
evaluation process, and then initiating
the investigation.
The EAC, right. Okay, let me work with it, and we'll get another draft to look at.
Okay. I think on the page 8, I guess. There's really, I think, only one. Top of the page, just clarifying that the decision date, the service date, I think that's good. And then we're striking assayer down below.
Yeah, I didn't play too much with these. Our rehearing language is, you know, old, but all the boards have this, and it's the same standard the AG's office uses for every board and commission, so I didn't play with that at all.
Yeah.
Which one is this?
It's Rule 126.
That's fine. 201.
201, just more of a cleanup. Like, in the age of photocopying, before things were sent to us electronically, the board used to request an original and one copy so we didn't have to make photocopies. I don't think that that's a problem anymore,
no.
So I thought to remove that, obviously remove mention to assayers. The number of examination hours we don't collect anymore, and in fact we haven't since I've been here.
Yeah.
It was particularly relevant to engineering when you had to take so many hours of exams. And it may also have related to NCARB exams like decades ago,
yeah.
But it isn't relevant anymore. Each exam has a name, and some take 8 hours, some take 6 hours, you know, some are 4 hours.
Now there's two structural exams.
Mm-hmm. Those are 8 hours each, but...
Well, but I thought there was a...
But it's still called the...
16 and a 24.
Mm-mm.
No?
It's just okay. Called the SE
shows
now.
Shows how far behind I am.
Yeah, it's just called structural
okay.
exam, and there's just two parts to it, but you have to pass both
okay.
in order to... It's just like the ARE and the LARE.
Mm-hmm. Recent cases we stipulated
16-hour
structural exam.
Right.
And that's why I thought, well, maybe there's a 24-hour structural exam.
In the olden days, there were 2 8-hour exams.
Okay.
So
now it's just one
block.
The
hours of exams is like really archaic, so I just thought to strike that. Like, for instance, the geology exams are now only 4 hours each.
Yeah.
So,
and I noticed you could take them in the same day. Well, I had some
mm-hmm.
questions about that, actually.
Yeah, and that was actually Eric Whelan's gift to us. So I don't know how you feel about that, but that's why it's in here for discussion.
I don't have a problem with taking them on the same day, but it says that you must pass the fundamentals before taking the professional.
Right, which is confusing.
So it's graded immediately? And who does that?
I don't believe they are.
I don't think they are either. So
I think ICs, they take time to get them graded just like NCARB does. I mean, it's a couple weeks before.
So I don't see how you can
take both
this language. You take them both
yeah.
on the same day if you have to pass one before the other.
Where is that, Bill? What's
it's on 15. It's on page 9, right in the middle.
Or is your registration contingent
yes.
on passing both?
It is.
Why do you specify that if they can do both in the same day,
why do they have to pass one first before the other?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so how about if I take that
the
out?
Professional and not be able to pass the fundamentals?
Yeah.
No, it wouldn't.
But you know what? But
you know,
I mean, it's testing. On the PE side of it,
yeah.
I know a lot of really talented engineering designers who have trouble with the FE. They don't have, maybe they haven't gone to college. They've worked their way up through the ranks. They're brilliant. They know every,
mm-hmm.
they know as much as the engineers or more as the engineers they're working under. You know, they're supervising them, but they can't pass the FE, so they
can't get registered. They can't get a waiver.
Yeah,
yeah. When I was in school, the idea that everyone said, you know, take the fundamentals while you're in school or as soon as you get out, because if you wait 3 or 4 or 5 years, you're going to forget half of need to know to pass the fundamentals.
That's what I did when I got out. I took the AIT back then mm-hmm. because it was structural, and it was the three structures exams, and it was materials and methods.
Mm-hmm.
It was all the what I called book smart stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you took that, you got it out of the way, and then you didn't have to be smart anymore. You just
but there's a good
no,
point.
I mean, because that stuff you don't retain.
But I think Leroy makes a good point here, is that why, you know, if you have to pass both, why does it matter if you pass one before
yeah.
the other?
Yeah.
Do you want to let them take both on the same day and then just cross out
why
the
not?
Back end of the...
Why
because
not?
They don't yeah. offer the geology exams as regularly as they offer
that's
the
right.
other exams.
I
think they're only offered twice a year, so... How
I would
if
just
we
say
just
put a period at the end of day,
day
instead of a
exactly.
comma, and delete
okay.
the rest of that sentence.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm okay.
That's cool. And then if they pass the professional but they don't pass the fundamentals, then
they
know they're going to have to
mm-hmm.
take the fundamentals but not worry about the professional. Okay. Okay. Any other
I have another comment on this page, if we want to move on.
So go ahead.
And that's evaluator. I just question whether this is delegating a key authority.
Is this which?
By putting this term evaluator. Is this is on paragraph. It starts on D, I think. Maybe.
Oh.
Yeah. Where you start referring to this evaluator, board
right.
staff or evaluator. And my only question, I like the idea of it because I know that the board uses people with
yeah.
specific technical knowledge, but my only question was, is the board delegating authority that it shouldn't be delegating?
Well, right now, I think...
We're still submitting them to the board for approval. In D, it says board staff and evaluator shall submit recommendations to the board for approval.
I mean, right now you have the authority. We've delegated authority to Grant to you.
Yeah.
So I'm really not coming to the board. And I'm not saying I have a problem, but what I'm wondering is I hate to add another layer of bureaucracy, but do we need to have this evaluator pool vetted in the same fashion we do our EAC members?
We do. We've only chosen the evaluators from the EAC pool.
Okay.
So the board's already vetted the guys who are looking at the...
So we've already vetted them. I'm wondering, do we need to maybe tweak this language a little bit that says that we're drawing this evaluation group from our pool of EAC members?
Okay.
Well, it says evaluator deemed qualified by the board, so that language...
Okay, so that is in there. Okay.
So maybe that's enough.
I mean, we can keep it committee, and we just have a committee of one or two, depending on how many people show up to review evaluation, review.
Committee always infers that there's more than one
right.
reviewing each application, and I don't want to make... That's burdensome to the board and even to the applicant
yeah.
and to the evaluators. I'd almost rather... I mean, right now, I think you only have Chip reviewing architectural ones in addition to Neil and I. And so...
You.
That, me. Oh, okay.
No, he may review some.
Yeah, I was going to say, he was whining at the last meeting about how many he had to review. He actually had more than I did, so... I was happy. So anyway, maybe I kind of like just to say evaluator deemed qualified by the board. I think getting rid of the committee terms maybe implies a group effort. I know you do that for engineering. You'll call in kind of a committee, and they'll all sit around and review apps.
But each one's looking at their own application,
yeah.
and they only discuss it if they have questions.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. And this is just a draft, too, guys. It
yeah.
may be that, when it gets to the full board, your colleagues have different opinions. It may be when it gets to the governor's office, they have different opinions.
Yeah.
Or GERC finally at the end has different opinions. Or when we receive input from the industries, they may decide this is a concern. So, We're certainly not done here today. It's just,
no,
Yeah.
Can I make a...
Yeah.
Sure, please.
Just for clarification, because you're here and you explained to us that deemed qualified by the board meant from the EAC, but would it be just as easy just to put that in there? Evaluate chosen from the EAC for evaluation? From the EAC?
If you want.
It's...
And that way,
I'm
you're not around to answer that question. It's clear.
And chosen from...
And selected from the pool of EAC
pool
members.
Pool of EAC members. Yep, done. That would work, and it does make it more clear.
Mm-hmm. And you don't have to guess.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, you're not allowed.
Is the EAC defined somewhere?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was defined in the investigative process.
Boy, that was a step forward when they created the EAC.
Yeah.
That was wrong.
That's a long
think,
time
right?
ago.
Yeah.
I've served on the EAC since sometime in the mid-90s.
Yeah, it's in 120.
Oh, I've got you.
Oh, I'm sure you do. You're a couple years older than me, right?
But if we don't refer to the EAC anywhere, or do you want to spell it out, or define what?
Well, we could maybe up above we could insert where we have Enforcement Advisory Committee. Maybe we can insert just in parens, you know, EAC, and that way it cleans it up. And
yeah.
Then we don't have to worry about it.
Right. That's what I'm suggesting.
An area where we've got definitions and.
You know, under definitions or somewhere, but if we're going to refer to it here, if we're going to use the acronym, is what I'm saying. Or maybe we just use it informally.
I have a question on C.
Yes, okay, so.
Can we get rid of the word examination? And just call them national councils. I mean, we have National Council of Architectural Registration Board, National Council of Engineering, whatever NCWS stands for. And we have CLARB, the Council of Landscape Architectural Registration. None of them say anything about examination, even though they administer exams.
They create
none
exams.
None of them.
Yeah. And let me just explain why I did that, because there's confusion down at the governor's office and in the legislature about the distinction between us and national councils. So,
this is to kind of help clarify.
And in our rule, when you look at it, national registration body is not true. They don't register anybody.
Right.
They just provide exams. Right. So
provide exams in the case of NCARB, documentation and record keeping.
So, I mean, I'm happy to call them just National Council, but I thought National Examination Councils made
That's
it
fine.
More clear.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm good with that.
Yeah.
I like
yeah.
it. I like it. On to the next page. Page 8. Just cleaning up the see anything under 3202 A or B that jumps out at me.
And there, again, in training is a designation, fundamentals is the exam.
Right.
So it's an archaic combination of the both. So I think this makes it clear for the public. We're not calling the exam the in-training exam anymore. We're calling it the fundamentals. Okay? And there's a distinction here at the board between an application to take a fundamentals and exam and an application for an in-training designation. So a lot of people applying to take the fundamentals don't really want the in-training designation anymore. So this way we're making it more clear in the rules the distinction between the exam and the designation.
Okay. So, one of my favorite categories, Article 3203, Waiver of Exam.
Again, very happy to cross
off. Just a question,
off.
Does in-training apply only to engineers?
No, geologists and surveyors can also apply for in-training designation.
Okay,
do we need to fix
something? Well, C says applicant for engineering training designation.
Yes. This is specific to engineers only. Some of the schools have an agreement with NCWS whereby they provide the fundamentals exam to their seniors and require them to pass it before they graduate, so it's become a graduation requirement in engineering schools. But, for instance, ASBOG does not have a similar agreement with NAU, the only school that offers a geology degree in Arizona. So that's why C is there, from my understanding. And, again, I just wanted to make it clear it was the fundamentals exam, not what was historically called the in-training exam.
And you inserted the word engineer in training.
Yes, because that's the only designation that we're aware of allowing that. Even surveyors, they don't have, as far as I know, do not have an agreement with schools for surveyors, so it's just for engineers.
Yeah, I think we're lucky to have any agreement with a school to maintain a 4-year degree.
Yeah.
We're just checking to see if you're still listening, Jason.
I've eaten 2 apples and had 3 cups of coffee.
Oh. Excellent. Are you walking around?
No.
No? Okay. So, 203, are we there yet, or do you guys still have questions about?
Let me look here. 203 is next. I need to just shoot a message real quick to a client because I'm not going to be able to.
You want
to
take a break?
Mm-hmm. Let's take a brief break.
Okay.
Yes, yes. A break would be good. We'll take a break.
We're taking a break, Jason.
Go get some more coffee, Jason.
How many
minutes
do I have?
10 minutes. Max.
Do you want to call back or you want us to call you? What?
I'll just hang on.
Okay.
I'll just leave the line open that way.
Hello. How are you? I'm excellent. You're a
Malaysian. Proof exam.
Yes.
So why are we striking paragraph 1?
It
still gives us that latitude to somebody doesn't have a NCARB certificate, they haven't worked the 10 years, how do they qualify for waiver of examination in Arizona? Mm-hmm. I see a bunch of these. Folks in California, folks in the Big 17 is what we need to look at. The 17 states that have similar registration requirements to Arizona do not require a degree or have accredited degree. They could work for, they could be newly licensed and we still could register them if they meet our qualifications.
I think because I don't have a good explanation for that, Ed.
you just hit the delete button. You just went happy with your delete button.
And Patty has had a comment too on it, but something about a fundamentals waiver, which
is down below.
Yeah.
That's D.
Right. If you guys want to keep it, I'm fine with it.
One requires that the documentation be essentially the same.
You know, substantially the thing, identical, yeah.
And what I struggle with in evaluating these is it says substantially identical to those existing in Arizona at the time of the applicant's original registration, certification, or licensure.
And that's hard to know.
You don't know that. I mean,
right.
I had a guy come in not too long ago. He'd been licensed for a very, very long time, probably 40-some years in another jurisdiction. Like, how do I know what the registration requirements were in Arizona 40 years ago?
That's probably why I struck it, honestly.
But what you could do is maybe just say, substantially identical to
those existing in Arizona, and then
but that opens the door. Then I don't want to have to. I can't require them to have ID.
Does it really matter? I've often wondered if it really matters about this.
If
they're licensed somewhere and another jurisdiction, and they've been practicing for 10 years,
or 5 years, or 1 year. I mean, it's just if they're licensed in another jurisdiction. I think right now, if somebody got licensed in California.
But that's not the case for engineers.
Okay, but I'm looking, I only know
architects.
So if they got licensed in California today and applied tomorrow for Arizona, I'd grant them a license.
Yeah, but we can't do it for engineers.
Why?
Because they only require 72 months of experience, not 96. So someone could get registered in California and still be a year more short for Arizona registration. So,
darn engineers.
I know. But that's why I think I took it out, because I thought...
Okay. Yeah, I'm an architect.
That's because I thought maybe the second paragraph was better.
Paragraph is a good one, but I guess I'm looking at the first paragraph and the second paragraph and going... right now, and I, again, I'm only speaking from the architectural side of it.
Right.
But quite honestly, if they hold a license in any other state, they've taken all. Again, it goes back to outcomes based evaluations. If they hold a license in another state and they haven't been brought up on any disciplinary charges, they don't have any enforcement issues against them, aren't they qualified to practice here? I mean, we have state-specific exams for certain disciplines, which are important. So if somebody's a professional land surveyor in California, they've taken the fundamentals exam, they've taken the professional exam, so they probably know what they're doing, you would hope.
I think you make it harder on yourself to try to track that.
Yeah, so why not just say, if you hold, it's almost, I'm sorry, we're getting almost, you want to make it easier? Mm-hmm. You know, we want to show that we're making it easier? Let's just say, if you hold a license in another state, we're going to grant. There's nobody, there's not a state in this, in the 54 jurisdictions that regulate architects that I wouldn't be comfortable granting a license to them unless they had disciplinary.
Okay, so
do we want to
strike it and just go with the applicant has to submit documentation they've been a professional in another state for 10 years?
Well, no, because...
Or strike 10 years, too.
Even the 10-year part of it, I'm wondering what is so magic about practicing for 10 of the last 15 years?
I don't know.
I think, again, if you know, there are folks... Well, let's use my partner for example. My partner Phil got his initial license in Colorado because that's where he was working. He moved to Arizona. He also got an NCARB certificate, so that simplified it. But he got licensed in Colorado. They have very similar licensure statutes to us. He took the ARE, got the experience. He had the national credit degree. Why doesn't he should have been able just to apply without an NCARB certificate and get a license?
But the 10-year thing, I think that was to cover people that had been practicing in other states under the grandfather clause for some as they were adding these professions
under
the grandfather clause.
So it's some older history there that, again,
well,
that needs
to
go away.
Arizona had its own geology exam, but other states didn't. So if you wanted to be a geologist...
Well, and I'm saying that geologists, land surveyor...
Other states
you take your state
didn't license geologists, mainly.
You're still going to be
there may have been one or two that didn't have an exam, but I think it was very few. I mean, that really... Most of the states, Arizona was the first. Hmm. So there were no other states that had geological licenses as far as
what if we write it so that they have to submit evidence that they have it's going to be evidence. I mean, their registration in that state is going to be that they have evidence, but maybe it is just verification that they passed the licensing exam.
Well, this is the waiver rule, so they don't want to pass the exam. They want to take the exam because...
No, this is so they don't have to retake it to get licensed in Arizona is the way I read this. Waiver of examination as applicable under paragraphs 1 and 2 is that you've already taken the exam and you've been practicing somewhere else and we're saying you don't have to take the exam to get licensed in Arizona.
Well, and let me explain my situation. When I came to Arizona, I had registration in Idaho because under the grandfather clause, because we had just a couple of years before passed it. So when I came to Arizona, I had not been practicing 10 years. I had only been practicing 8 years. So that meant that since I hadn't been practicing 10 years, I had to take the examination. So then I took the examination and got registration. But I think that 10-year thing...
Well, and don't forget, guys, last session we got the statute change that now requires someone who's been out of practice for more than 5 years to retest if they apply for reactivation.
Yeah.
So.
And I think that's fine.
This is for, this rule, from what I think of it as, is a rule for somebody who never took a national exam, who's been practicing for a long time in a state or jurisdiction that didn't require it. So, like, say, New York just started licensing geologists. But they have probably grandfathered in a bunch of professional geologists without requiring them now to sit for the ASBOG exams.
Right.
So, say that New York professional geologist who didn't take the test wanted to come and practice in Arizona, he could apply for a waiver and say, well, I've been practicing as a professional geologist in New York for this amount of time. I don't want to and I don't need to take the test.
I think that's a good clarification, because I think now what we need to do is I think we need to break our, we use the term reciprocity candidates, even though that's not what we have.
Right.
But it's kind of what we're aiming at. So we have a group of registrants that on this side that have all taken a national exam. They're licensed in another jurisdiction, mm-hmm. and they want to get licensed in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a group that may be licensed in another jurisdiction, but because of a grandfathering clause, mm-hmm. has never had to take
the national exam.
So what we need to do is come up with two separate rules that address those two categories. So we have a category of registrants who, regardless of how long they've been licensed, they are applying in Arizona and they want a license, but they already have one and they've already taken and passed the national exam.
So then they would just apply for registration.
So they could,
because they already have exam scores.
But now what we need to do is we need to say, what are the conditions of that application? What do they need to provide us? And quite honestly, you know, I get a lot of sole practitioners that apply in Arizona for waiver through waiver of exam or reciprocity, that or comedy, whatever you want to call it, that, you know, their actual work experience, they may be a one-man operation and they don't have anyone supervising them,
mm-hmm.
so they can't really do a COE.
We've had some engineers.
And engineers like that. So, but they've been, you know, maybe they got their license and then they struck out on their own, or maybe they've been doing it for 30 years and, you know, there's no reason to get past employment history, because I had one that gave me COEs. They somehow dug up all their people from the 80s. And I'm thinking, I wouldn't even know how to track down some of the people that were in the 80s, you know.
Yeah,
I
think those were real?
Well, and they... You know, they might have been. Who knows? You just don't know. But why put them through all of that if they already hold, you know, a valid registration, and they're maybe that we just need some kind of a sworn affidavit and their, I mean, they can get their exam results. We can get that certificate from the state, the certificate of registration from each state. It says, yes, they're licensed, and they were licensed, they're initially licensed in this state, and they were licensed, they took this exam. Took ARE, you know, 1983.
Well, and I'm seeing a few that they didn't apply for, through the board, for taking the exam. Then they spend a few years taking the exam, pass it, and then they apply to the board, mm-hmm. for registration. And they've never been registered anyplace else. But they're taking the exam directly with CLARB,
mm-hmm.
without applying to the board.
Mm-hmm.
See, that falls under initial registration rules, not,
mm-hmm. yeah.
not waiver of examination rules.
Right.
And they're going to have to give you COEs in your case, or they're going to have to show fulfillment of
well,
AXP
and,
with
and
the
through CLARP, they're showing the experience.
Right.
Oh, okay.
So, and again, this is working with the square peg, and now we're kind of using a round hole, mm-hmm. at this point.
Yeah. We've got some really antiquated language here that needs cleaning up. You know, maybe this is another one where we just need to sit down and wordsmith it some more.
The
this all was done long before mm-hmm. the national councils mm-hmm. started asserting themselves on tests.
Okay, so
maybe this is, you know, we've got six or seven.
I have a couple comments.
Okay, go ahead, Jason.
The first one is, at least with the land surveying, in this we have the opportunity to have a state exam, which
right.
would be outside of the national stuff.
Right.
And I think the consideration is that if somebody passed their national exams, we certainly don't make them take it twice.
We do
enforce the state exam if for any other reason than its familiarity with our state laws.
Oh,
that
absolutely.
Seems to be kind of a general sentiment that I get when I talk to the other states' land surveyors when they talk about their state exams, too. As far as the grandfathering and the old pre-national board people, what do we got? 10 years of that, maybe, left, optimistically?
Yeah.
Do we really need to address it? I mean, all that stuff, all the I didn't take an exam, but I'm an engineer type of people, the grandfathered people, they're dying out. They're going to be gone in 10 years. So is it something we really need to spend a lot of time on?
So sensitively put, Jason.
You know, and along those lines, I'm thinking we could blow out this whole rule and rewrite it, one for reciprocity and one for those who really do need a waiver.
Yeah.
What, I don't know. How do you guys feel about that?
That would certainly make it more current with today's reality.
I think so.
Okay.
Maybe you and I can get together,
Melissa,
before the next meeting and write, draft something up.
Sounds
to
good.
Present back to the group. Yeah, I guess I'm trying.
One thing I'd like to focus on when we move ahead with that is that we exempt our state-specific exam from that. And I don't want to allude to anybody that they can come to Arizona and just get a surveying license.
No,
they have to take the state exam because our state laws are different.
Right. No, we would write into that rule any state-specific exams would have to be taken as a condition of licensure.
Yeah. And I mean, that's just the way we do it now. I just wouldn't want to mislead anybody.
I just think we need to streamline it a little bit and make the evaluation process a little bit simpler.
Okay, so we'll look to rewrite 203 entirely.
Somewhere in here is the foreign applicant. Is it in the rules or is it in statute?
It is in statute. Oh. It is similar to...
It's the 10 year, it's the 10 or 15 year thing, and I know we hate that, but we're not going to...
Well, see, that's why I sneakily crossed out or jurisdiction.
Well, you need to do it up in A then, because you have in another state or jurisdiction at the end of paragraph A. I saw you took
that. Yeah,
so
you're right.
Let's take it out in A as well.
Good point.
That way, if you just say, well, we have to be careful. Guam is not a state. Puerto Rico is not a state. How about if we said state or U.S. territory?
Okay.
That way we're confining it to those jurisdictions that are a part of
U.S.
governance.
Right. And belong to the National Examination Councils.
Yes.
Which may not exist. And 204 may be another one, too, that... And the reason I say that is because as I was looking at 204, you'll see all that I added down here is really to accommodate those people who don't have an architect degree, who need to come to us for authorization to test, and we need some criteria to determine whether they're 60 months of experience only qualifies them. So I went back and took what is now Section 14 out of the old AIT definition, because you guys who are evaluating these apps are looking for some guidance about whether
what I would rather insert in there is what is on the app, is on the COE form.
Okay.
And actually, I'd like to now further refine it. When I developed that, I did it with the intent of paralleling the then IDP 16 areas of training. I'd like to go now and look at AXP with the more streamlined thing and insert that in there, and maybe that way it still ensures the diversity of experience. I never did like this with some of these limits on here and stuff, construction reviews, maximum credit 12 months.
But you know where I'm going with this.
No, I understand. Like, no, I'm on board with the concept.
Okay.
But what I would like to do is, rather than using A through H in there, I would like to, because it references that lousy sub-professional experience.
Yeah.
What I would like to do is insert specific training areas out of the AXP. So I can work with you on that as well.
Okay. And then, Bill, I see in the Section 11 up here, that same language about taking the geology, and it shouldn't be in training, it should be the fundamentals exam.
Fundamentals examination on the same date, period.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so Ed, I'll work with you on revising these two.
Yeah.
And then C gives them the option, if they have a degree, to go right to the applicable national council to take that specific exam.
Direct application.
Right. And then the last thing, and then in Section 3, we have the intent that you take and pass the exam, but the rule has to say take and pass rather than just take. So we've actually had applicants argue with us over that. Well, I took it, I failed, but you can't close my application because the rule doesn't say I had to pass it, I just had to take it. So this clarifies that. And then
under 3, just to clean up a little bit of language, an applicant professional examination category must take and pass an examination, maybe, instead of the, because you say an examination in the next sentence.
Okay. An exam.
And because if you say the examination, that would imply that an architect would have to take and pass all 5 or 6 divisions.
Well, we do have something that distinguishes between multi-divisional.
Do we?
Yeah.
I mean, because most of them are multi, you know, even, like you said, the structural.
Structural's the only one.
Only one?
Of the engineering exams, that's multi-divisional.
I mean, those engineers get off easy.
What about these? What about the timing of this in 3? It says you have to take it and pass within a year. What if you take it and fail and want to retake it and can't take it within that year?
Yeah, you got to reapply.
That may be
is that necessary?
Construed as an undue burden.
That could be, you're right.
And the reason I say that is some of the exams are only offered once a year. I don't know that we need a
full form. All of them are offered. Even the geology exam is offered twice a year. And now,
I'm not as familiar with the professions.
The other 4 even, with the surveyors, are going to be going, computer-based, Jason, they're going to go CBT. I think they already are.
Yeah, they already are.
Yeah, so
I think it was this year.
So
about
year,
I think the surveyors can take it 8 out of the 12 months. Engineers maybe 2.
Architects, you got to wait 30 days.
Yeah, but you can take it pretty regularly, and I think with CLARB, landscape architects can take it pretty regularly with the CBT as well. So it's only geology, and even they offer it twice a year.
Okay.
NICES is there's
Still just twice a year?
No, currently it's, I think you can take it 8 out of the 12 months, and there's no wait time in between like with NCARB.
And the only reason there's like a 30-day wait is they reset the metrics on the exam every 30 days. And so
because
they
some over there that are registering, they're registering, say they can't take it before April.
That may be because the window opens up in April.
Could be.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure we're not, what's the logic behind closing their application?
The logic behind it are the time frames, as far as I can tell, because we all inherited this language. I don't know where this one-year thing came from. All I can think of is it has to do with the time frames rules that have come in to say you don't want to keep your applications pending and pending and pending and pending.
But the time frames are based on staff action, not applicant action. So if the applicant does fulfill their requirement of it, in other words, they take the exam, and whether they pass or not, that to me, once they take that exam, it takes any pressure off of our side of it to say, well, you just haven't.
Yeah, the one I brought over, she had taken the exam, failed it, and she was one of those that was from the construction school. And she failed it, so she had to apply all over again.
But here's the argument on the other side, guys. In a year, applicants' information can change, and the board won't know. So applicants are fairly transitory because they're young. They'll move apartments. Their work situations will change. Certain things that regulatory boards need to know, they won't have access to if they don't reapply on a fairly regular basis. We won't know how to contact them. We won't know if their qualifications for later applications and registration actually, you know, are different. Their citizenship status can change. Someone who's, you know, here on a visa could become a permanent resident or a citizen, and we wouldn't know that if we keep the applications open.
What about on an annual basis? They have to complete all of that information and not close it. On the one, and I see where you're coming from, but on the other hand, it appears overall as a pushing back and making it more difficult to get registered.
So
from the other side.
And here's another way that we need to be looking at this in addition to our outcomes-based process. We're about to roll out computer-based applications, renewals, the whole thing, which I would assume is going to have the capability of emailing people and all of that. So maybe we need to kind of take this, look at this with technology in mind as well in our new system and say, and again, this helps boost what we're, our image is, we're rolling out this computer system, and it's going to allow us to say, okay, Mr. Applicant or Ms. Applicant, you need to update your information.
Were you convicted of a felony?
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, rather than making them send in money every year that they don't pass an exam.
Because that,
well,
it's from the outside, it looks like producing the application.
It's not just the money.
Oh, no, I understand, but it's the whole thing. Yeah, they got to go back and get COEs again.
Yeah, and it's a burden.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's...
So I think a way to get rid of this one-year requirement.
Yeah, I think year is too short. Is with the idea that if someone fails the examination, getting back to take it, getting the time to take it, getting signed up to take it, all that sort of thing.
When they have to sign up with the national councils to take the exams, don't they have to complete that information?
Yeah.
They complete some of it, but they don't complete, like, the citizenship and the disciplinary action information.
But their contact information would be there.
Right.
So they could then reach out to them and say...
Not necessarily, because the national councils don't always have the most current information on their candidates.
That's true. Yeah.
I don't know why. And some are better at it than others, like NCARB's better at it than NCWS. It's just, and NCWS wasn't keeping its own test scores until recently, believe it or not. So, I mean, it's definitely up to you. We'll, if you think a year is too short, that's fine. I mean, we want to be user-friendly. We don't want to be obstructionists. So, I'm just telling you that I think circumstances can change and often do with applicants.
But, does it really matter in terms of whether, does it matter if they're a citizen or not?
No. They just have to legally be able be in the country, is what Arizona has said.
And how does California deal with it? Because they're kind of the Pacific thing for everybody from China and everybody else.
Yeah, I don't know how California deals with it. But Arizona, we require candidates to fill out form. There's a law, apparently, and since at least 2007, 2008, the AG's office makes all candidates fill out these forms. I mean, it's really quite intense. And then they have to demonstrate that their visas are current and or that they have...
Kind of visa?
Exactly. There's a list of various acceptable forms that they can provide. I mean, it's...
Because I ran into graduate engineer from Mexico that's just coming up here to study English, mm-hmm. who also wants to get registered up here after he gets his English down. And he's a graduate of University of Sonora in civil engineering.
Mm-hmm.
Can't imagine anyone wanting to go into that, but he does.
Yeah, so we're just saying... We're just trying to deal with the rule as it is, but if you want to change the 1 year, I don't see why we couldn't take it within a year. I think the idea was to make sure we could keep the information about the applicants current. Honestly, that's what I think it was in there for.
And that should be a responsibility of applicants once they turn in an application.
They're just an applicant. They're not
right.
Technically.
Yeah, right.
We don't have any regulatory authority over that part of it.
We ask them repeatedly over and over again in all the correspondence. Please let the board know what your current address and contact info are. And there's so many that don't. It's kind of.
But you know what? That's their problem. If they can't be grown up enough to keep the board updated with their address or their workplace or anything like that, maybe they're not registered.
Well, I don't think another year or even 2 years, it's going to make any real difference. We don't have current information. At some point they're going to pass the. Hopefully, they'll pass the examination and they'll get registered, and then you will have current information. We'll have to in order for them to give them the certificate, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I just think the years. It's too short, especially if someone fails the exam. If they pass it, it's not a problem.
To me, on the architect side of it, 3 years is kind of a good cutoff because they're eligible to take all parts of the ARE, right?
Ones in six are getting the 5 years to take and pass. So in...
Okay, that's not clear to me in the rule. I was looking at it because we say
it's a new... It's in the new... Right. Section.
I mean, I see what you're saying, and I agree with that, but when I read, where did it go?
I
lost it.
By the way, in C, that you list the other, everybody except geologists is not in here.
And there was a reason for that. Oh, because... ASBOG doesn't recognize an applicable national council. So everybody who wants to apply for geology exam has come through Arizona. So they can't just go to ASBOG and sign up for the test like the other professions. They have to come to the state specifically. That's why they're not included there. It's really confusing, yeah. Guys. I mean, the licensing stuff at this agency is really detailed.
Yeah. Item number six, close an application if it fails to pass all divisions of the applicable examination. For example, we approve an architect and give them a year to take it, and they pass three of the seven. Do then we cancel their application?
No. As long as they've taken it, one test within the first year, their application, their authorization.
What about after that first year? For example, we've extended. They applied a few years, didn't take it. Then that we extend it, give them another year to take it.
Yeah, I want to stop that. And it should be authorization instead of application, because the application... has been made in process. So what they're looking for is authorization. It's subsection 6.
6.
The board shall close an authorization for if you fail to pass all the divisions within 5 years.
But see, that runs afoul with the NCARB 5-year rolling clock, because NCARB allows you to keep testing, but what happens is that one that's 5 years falls off, you just have to retake it.
Right.
But NCARB does not make you reapply. They just make you retake that exam if you don't pass the whole body within 5 years.
But what NCARB's doing is referring people back to us now to say, do you still want them to be authorized? And they will close authorizations if Arizona
if the
says,
state, if
yeah.
the jurisdiction, but yeah. okay.
So we can wordsmith.
Yeah, I have mixed emotions about that. I mean, I've seen people that just, they struggle with like one exam.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like I've had staff like that that just, I desperately wanted them to get licensed, and then finally they just give up, and then they get axed.
Yeah.
You know,
but then we've seen them in front of the board where they got the authorization 10 years ago, and they don't do anything, and, you know, oh, we don't want to do IDP.
But if you extend them, and they pass part of it, because I know you'll be getting a letter on it, and they've taken it, they passed three of the seven, do we cut them off from and not approve them to take it, or do we allow them to continue on taking it?
I don't know. It just really depends on the case, you know. If they've passed some, I don't know that we've ever said you have to stop testing.
Well,
as long as
it came in for an extension, was given an extension.
I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. We'd have to look at the file and say why. Sometimes with NCARB, they change the exam so much that you may have taken three old ones and then...
Yeah, but they fixed that now. Because now they learned from the 3.0, 4.0 transition, that was a disaster. And they've learned, so they've actually developed a coordination matrix that if you're in 4.0, you can transition to 5.0. It's very clean. I've actually got some folks in my office who started in 4.0, and they're transitioning in to take 5.0. And
I think the 1 year...
No complaints.
Gives the governor's office ammunition.
You do.
You think what? Yeah.
I think it's too severe. Not this ammunition that we're making it too difficult for people to.
And it's restrictive. I tend to agree.
A 3-year window is a minimum, just because that's kind of like I said, for architects, they fulfill their education or experience requirement to qualify for the exam, and then they've got 3 years of experience they've got to amass, and so now their application to exam is open for those 3 years.
Well, I think it's very confusing because I think in especially the architects, they're thinking of the 5-year rolling clock from NCARB.
Yeah.
They're not even on their radar this 1 year that their application's about to be closed.
And maybe it's not tied to passing. Maybe it's just you take the exam within the 3-year window. You have to start taking exams within a certain period rather than take and pass. Because there is a financial aspect to this. The exams are not cheap.
Well, and the take and pass really is specific. The more problems we see are with the architect apps because, you know, NCAR...
Well, we're just problem children.
You get the authorization, you take, you fail, you take, you fail, you take, you fail, and NCAR will let that continue, but our board...
We'll allow it to continue in perpetuity, quite honestly.
We're saying, maybe you should rethink this after, you know, 5 years or...
Well, and maybe that's a conversation we need to have with NCAR, mm-hmm. is do we need to, you know, rethink the examination strategy? If you can't pass one of the exams after 5 years, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
I know.
Everyone said to me, don't worry, everyone fails at the first time. I'm like, oh no, I am not failing.
Well, back when this is back in the dark ages, when you actually had to do drawings with a pencil, the ARE had a 39% first-time pass rate.
Wow.
And when I took it, it was in the Stone Age.
No, it was once a year.
And
it was once
dark
a year.
Ages.
Yeah, it was in June.
God. All right.
Zip along here, because I have to leave by noon, guys.
I have to leave
in 10 minutes because I have my parking meters going
to
run out. One logistical thing, we refer to NCAR, but can we put the initials after when you actually say what NCAR is so that people...
Oh, National Council.
Architect Registration Boards.
It's stated, but I don't think we put the initials behind it so that we know what that means.
Is it up there?
We do.
In 203.
Oh, in 203.
Section 1, if you just put in brackets after National Council of Architectural Registration Board, you can put NCAR in there.
Oh.
And you can have at it.
Do it for NCEES, do it for FARB. Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Because it's a whole different language if you're not used
under
to
paragraphs B, 1, 2, and 3.
Just put the acronyms,
in
there. Okay.
After, in parens. That'll clean it up a little. That's a good idea.
I like that. She must be an engineer.
Let's see.
Okay.
Let's go to education and work experience. I have some edits I want to make there.
And this is the rule that Wiley wants us to look at to make more accommodating. And I think it's a valid argument, honestly, given how education is changing now.
And that's really a dialogue that we need to engage some of our engineer members on, because I'm assuming that these construction management candidates are coming in under the PE regulations, not architect, and so...
And some of our evaluators are more generous than others.
Well, and really, if it's going to start at this level, which it would, let's get Ron engaged and kind of get his input on it, just to make sure that, you know, they're comfortable with it.
Has anybody had a conversation with Ron about serving on the L&R committee?
Ron Starling?
Yeah.
We invite him, but he has missed a lot, and so what I'm thinking is maybe we should just...
He's in the process of moving, I think, you know,
from
Phoenix to Prescott, pretty much.
And
I think it's
finished.
Just more difficult for him.
We do have Bob Stanley. He just wasn't able to attend today.
Oh, he's
today.
On the... Okay, well, we could engage Bob in that.
Right. Bob, and I know Jason has some ideas about this as well, and Alejandro, I mean, they argue endlessly about who gives more credit than the other.
Yeah.
And
I'm thinking if we start at this level, get Bob engaged, and then get his input on it once we get the information from ASU.
Back
to,
I just have this question, and this is aside from the engineering issue, but it's about geology. Like, for instance, your colleague Steve doesn't have a geology degree. He has a master's in geology, but he doesn't have a bachelor's. We don't account for that here. Do you feel like we should? I mean, are we only going to give Steve... How much credit would we give Steve if he were a new applicant? Would we give him the 48 months because he has a master's in geology, even though his bachelor's was like in liberal arts? I mean, I think he was a history major.
Isn't that part of geology?
Yes, exactly.
You know, if you were evaluating Steve now, would you give him 48 months, or would you give him something less than that?
Well, I would say it depends on his coursework. I mean, it depends on, you know, what his transcript says. It would to me, if I were reviewing him.
I think that's how you review it.
I look at the transcript and I say, does this person have the fundamental courses that, you know, that I think a geologist needs to have to be a geologist? And he would have to have them to get a master's degree in geology.
He would, okay.
I mean, they wouldn't just give him, you know, let him take all master's level courses without having the fundamental stuff.
And I look at it almost that same way with landscape architects, because they have a degree in zoology, and then all at once they're getting a master's in landscape architecture.
Michelle, thanks for your input. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And next time, park in the garage, because then there's no time limit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So I just come in from that back street?
From Washington.
Off of Washington, there's a parking garage. Just pull in there. It says two-hour limit.
And
I don't know of anybody that's enforced it in 20 years.
And for 6 years, I've only gotten one little slip on my vehicle.
Okay, really? Well, that's good to know. Because I thought, it's just like, came in a different way this time, and I think I was in the parking garage last time, but this ends it. Thank you so much. I'll see you in a couple
months. So, back on education credit.
I mean, are we giving the right amount? I think for architects we are.
I want to clarify some text there. So okay. So, under architectural evidence, I want to take out 5-year, I just want to say NAB accredited degree, 60 months.
Yeah.
Because if you go to the U of A, you'll get a NAB accredited degree and you get in 5 years. If you go to ASU, in 6 years, you'll get a NAB accredited degree. They're both NAB accredited degrees. They both ought to get credit.
The same.
Okay.
The same. The paragraph B, there is no such thing as a 4-year NAB degree.
I thought that was the ASU 4-year program.
That's not NAB accredited.
It's not, okay.
No. It's a Bachelor of Science in Architecture or a Bachelor of Arts in Architecture. You'd only get the accredited degree if you go into the master's program at ASU.
Okay, so how do we want to reword that?
Now I'm going to throw another wrench in it, because I think the U of A might have just gotten their master's program accredited, and so now if you get an accredited degree from the U of A and you get a master accredited master's, you're still only technically getting 5 years, which maybe that's okay. Because quite honestly, people with master's degree, at least from what I've experienced, they're not a whole lot more valuable than people with a bachelor's. I mean, unless they want to go into academia or something, then that's where the value of a master's comes in. But a year in the seat doing work in the office is usually more valuable than a year in the classroom. After the degree standpoint. So,
NAB accredited degree equals 60 months. What about an architecture degree that isn't NAB? Is that 48 months?
Right now we're given 36, but I think we need to reevaluate that, and I think it probably should be 48. But
so instead of calling it a 4-year NAB degree, we call it a non-NAB accredited degree. It gets you 48
months.
Well,
no, because let me look at some of the language that NCARB has drafted for the CART, the Credential Alternative Review.
Okay.
Because we dealt with that issue, and I can't remember how we worded it, because we designate the submittal requirements for CART into someone with an architecture-related degree and someone without an architecture-related degree.
Okay.
And the requirements are different, so we can tweak that a little bit.
And Leroy, are we okay with a 5-year LAAB accredited degree, or?
Almost all of them are 4-year now.
So take out 5-year.
And they are.
Okay.
And they're
accredited, but they're 4-year degrees.
Right.
So should we give them 48 months?
Give them 48?
That's what I've been giving them.
48. Okay.
For bachelor's.
And?
Well, here we go. So it's actually subparagraph D. Landscape architectural applicants with a 4-year lab accredited degree, 48 months. So maybe we just strike C?
Well, what do we do about a master's?
Yeah, I mean, if they have a master's, are there lab-accredited master's programs that would give them the 60 months?
Okay.
What if we just said, landscape architecture applicants with a lab-accredited master's degree, 60 months, and then a lab-accredited degree, 48, would that work?
Yeah. Okay. And then we're giving... Yeah, and see, with the engineers, it gets more convoluted because you get people with various degrees in engineering, but then they want to apply for a different branch in real life than what their degree is in. So they get less credit, even though they may have gone to ASU and gotten an ABET accredited civil engineering degree. Mm-hmm. If they apply to be a mechanical, they're not getting 48 months, they're getting 36. Because of the education specific is different.
Yeah. So it is very complicated for engineers.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the provision that allows you to get up to 60 months if you have a master's degree? Where is that?
It is really only dealt with for the engineers in C. And that's why I was talking about, for geologists, we probably want to put in a provision about geologists getting a master's degree. In C, we just added the master's degree to equals 60
architects.
Months for landscape architects.
Oh, in C, for landscape.
And we did not deal with it in architecture because Ed was saying that the NAB-accredited degree would get you 60 months, whether it's a master's or a five-year program, right?
Yeah, because you could get an ABET architectural degree with a nursing background, and a NAB-accredited master's with a nursing background, you're going to go 2 to 3 years instead of maybe 1 or 2, and we'll give you 60 months.
Mm-hmm. So I think for the engineers, I liked what Wiley suggested, which is adding engineering applicants with an ABET accredited or equivalent bachelor's degree in a branch of engineering get 48 months, something like that. And then those with a four-year degree in a branch other then what they want is 36 months. And then surveyors get 48 months if they get an accredited bachelor's degree in surveying.
Right.
I don't even know if there are very many programs left that offer that. But
well, we need to keep that going for out of state. There's a few programs throughout the country and very valid. So.
Okay. Do you think we need to provide for anything else? I don't know about a master's in surveying.
No, if you get a master's in surveying, you might want to think about a change of career.
Okay. And so that's why I thought maybe we should add a provision for master's in geology.
I think we should. I recall giving 60 months when I was reviewing applications
for
people
masters.
With masters, but I don't now see where the basis of
right,
is.
There isn't.
What if we just said geology applicants with a bachelor's degree in geology, 48 months, geology applicants with a master's degree in geology, 60 months?
I think that would be fine.
Just codify it that way.
With a bachelor's.
I mean, you know,
Yep.
My kid's in point. They didn't take 4 years to get through college. It took them 5.
Yeah, that's true.
So just say degree.
A degree. Bachelor's degree.
Bachelor's or master's.
I like that. Okay. And then I can't even make sense of Section 2. All other education credit. not granted for, unless your school is accredited. I don't even know if the U.S. Department of Education is the right accrediting body anymore.
You know, and almost it's like the way it's going, I mean, NAB is accrediting colleges all over the world now.
Yeah, and I don't know if in determining pro rata credit, 30 semester hours or 45, I don't know if that's the right semester hours or any of that, if that's still current.
I looked at that with Patty when she was doing the research, and I think it's pretty close, but we can revisit it.
Okay.
But I think based on the NAB education standard, it's pretty close.
Okay. And then E is always a bone of contention among those candidates who are overachievers. Someone could work full-time and be going to school full-time, and this section penalizes mm-hmm. them. Because you can't get more than 12 years experience or 12 months experience in a 12-year period, in a 12-month period of time.
Right.
And I brought it back a couple years, you know, when I first started in 2009, I brought it to the board and the engineers were like, no, you can't get more than 12 months credit for a 12-month period of time. And I said, but you're penalizing overachievers. I don't, we don't care.
Well,
and
especially in today's world with online courses.
Yeah.
So what do you think about eliminating that?
I'm fine with eliminating it. Because this is the one hiccup with the alternative path.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because you could get, I mean, even though it still totals up to 8 years, there is some work study stuff going on, and I got interns in my office. I got a young lady who's working, you know, she's only working 16 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't she getting credit for that?
Well, yeah, because if she's in school, then she can only get the school credit
the
work credit.
Yeah.
And right.
It's like she ought to get both.
I know.
It's all valuable.
Okay. So I'll propose removing that. And actually, I think that might work for the governor's office, too, that we're not penalizing our overachievers.
Yep.
You know, okay, yay.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that.
Overachievers are efficient human beings.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, and you're right, with online school and all the different ways to get your education now, why shouldn't we try to accommodate?
Uh-huh.
It's going to be a hard sell for the engineers, just so you guys know.
Well, I got some other hard sells for them.
Okay.
There are some hard lessons.
Well, I'm an engineer, it wasn't hard for me.
So. Oh, good.
One of the big arguments that we have to make in all of this is, and it goes back to reciprocity, is we are allowing applicants from other states who come in who will have the 60 months and 3 years of AXP for Arizona. We're going to have applicants, reciprocity applicants, coming in with NCARB certificates who only have 7 years of experience.
Yep, I know. And
so we're making it easier, and this is another good case for the governor's office, we're making it easier for out-of-state people to work in this state than we are our in-state people, and that's not right.
That's true.
But that's what he likes.
He likes the out-of-state people to come?
That's his whole thing, is that people should be able to come into Arizona and make a living. And not have all the obstacles that we currently have.
Well, sure, but what I'm saying is that we're going to open the door for these, we're going to remove those obstacles for the out-of-state people to come in and make a living, but we also are going to make it easier for our in-state people to make a living.
Yeah, and
that's
unconstitutional to distinguish that way. So, of course, he believes in mixing the power, you know, he should have all the power, but, you know, no separation of powers, but regardless, I think that's a cool.
But what I'm proposing requires a statute change. It's not in rule.
Yeah, because we have the 96-month thing.
Yeah.
But you'll eventually end up with people that did the alternative path, the licensure.
Right.
You know, were able to pass the exam right out of college, that don't necessarily have all that.
That's true.
That they're going to be coming
mm-hmm.
in.
It's true.
Well, and what they're going to do is they're going to get licensed in California
mm-hmm.
or Idaho or something like
right,
that.
Right, more accommodating state.
Or New
Do
Mexico
you know?
Or whatever, and then they're going to get licensed here and we're going to grant them.
Yeah.
and they got a year less experience.
If ASU was granted?
I don't think so. I don't think that they've applied.
They haven't applied yet. Okay.
They're in the process of a director search. And
yeah, New Bay hasn't either because they're looking for a director too. So
okay.
U of A hasn't made any progress on it. They're still looking for a new
director. I think if ASU goes, I think U of A will go at the same time.
Yeah.
I think they'll go as a package deal.
Yeah.
But
they're not ready yet. Okay.
Yeah, they're both looking for leadership.
Cool. Okay, guys. I didn't mess with the hours. I don't know.
That always makes my head.
Yeah, if like, the hours are accurate anymore, or if you want to make changes.
You know, this is so prescriptive. I mean,
I know.
To me, it's like work is work.
I know. So, 130 hours is full time for a month, but between 85 and 129 is only half time.
The numbers are written out in word form in one, but the number forms is like two and three.
Who knows?
You know what? I would almost rather strike one, two, and three and just say experience shall be substantiated by the employer before the board grants credit.
I'm fine with that.
I don't know how you guys feel about it, but it's just...
Well, I think what this does is it gives the reviewer some basis for making a decision about how many if we're gonna go through the process of figuring out experience and tallying it up, then having some guidelines to do that is useful.
Yeah,
it makes it more fair for every applicant because they're under the same standard. They're not subject to the whims of the individual.
The only place we ask this is on the COE, and it's how many hours a week do you work?
Right.
And I've rarely see any below 40.
Oh, there are.
Are there?
Yeah, 25, 16.
30.
You know, 30. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of that.
Have you?
Over the past few years with a bad economy, I think, just part-time.
Yeah, that's probably it.
People.
But again, I guess... to me, maybe this is overly complicated because let's say they're working 16 hours a week and they say they've worked there for 12, let's make the math easier. They're working 20 hours a week and they've been there a year. Well, that's 6 months of credit.
Mm-hmm.
That's half time. Let's just keep it simple.
Except they don't keep it simple.
No, I'm saying let's keep it simple. In our rule, it just says that You get an hour's credit for an hour worked. And when so if you put on the form, how many hours a week did you work? 20 hours. And you were there and you show 12 months of work time period, then that's 6 months worth of credit. Because...
I think that works good for me because it doesn't really promote the applicant into kind of fabricating numbers or fluffing up numbers. It just enables them to report accurately, and then we say, okay, 20 hours a week divided by, whatever equals this many months.
Yeah.
So, actual months, I mean.
Yeah, if they're 4 months, then, that's...
Two months credit.
To me, that just really simplifies it. It's still... holds them, but they get credit, and again, it's making it easier, and they get credit for every hour they work, because when Christina's in my office doing her 16 hours that she doesn't get credit for right now, and still wouldn't under this, but she's a valuable contributor to my firm.
Yeah, that's between 85 and 129.
And she's getting valuable experience.
Yeah.
They're working 129 are getting gypped.
Yeah, I'm looking at it going, well, I'm going to do the 85.
Right.
I only have to work half time and yet I get...
I like that. 1 hour credit for 1 hour worked. Right?
Yeah.
That's what you said.
That's pretty much...
Bill?
That's simple. I like it simple. Simple's good.
All right. Cool. And then we'll keep experience substantiated by the employer before the board grants credit,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. You all right with that too, Jason?
Say that again.
We're going to eliminate in subcategory B 1, 2, and 3 and replace it with 1 hour credit for 1 hour worked and keep 4, which says experience shall be substantiated by the employer before the board grants credit.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay.
One thing that I've thought about, maybe it's, I'm just going to toss it out there. I don't know if it's applicable or not, but one of the things that kind of crossed my mind as I look at evaluations, something that I think we could strengthen is the professional's responsibility to accurately report. And I don't know that I've had any bad cases, but I think I've had good cases where a professional will support the time, but they'll say that maybe the time isn't as much professional as the applicant thought. So you end up with less time than the applicant reports because the registrant is kind of betting that time. In addition to just saying they work this time, they're saying that this time falls in a certain category. Where I'm going with this is I think it could go the other way too, and I might never notice it, but a registrant could just kind of, dare I use the word lie, I'm going to use the word lie, lie on an application, and I don't mean that in a malicious or an intentional way, but they could just, let's say, optimistically report time because, I don't know, Billy's a good kid or Mary's a single mom or whatever, you know, for some other reason. And I don't know if there's a way that we can stress upon the registrant that they're certifying to this information and maybe they have some accountability for it. You know, I think that everybody I talk to, is, you know, as I say that in a negative sense, I think that everybody I talk to is the opposite and they hold their professional responsibility in high regard. But when I look at applications, I sometimes wonder too. So.
Well, and actually, we not too long ago had a case because it's one that it was an application I reviewed, and I smelled something fishy with it about this guy certifying this guy's work and had he really worked for the guy and all of that, and ended up with 2 enforcement cases out of it and an aiding and abetting finding against the registrant. So, you know, I think a lot of times those kind of They have to be pretty darn good, I think, mm-hmm. to get past us with that. But you're right, Jason. But otherwise, it's kind of, yeah, we're doing it and we're kind of taking it on good faith.
So all of that being said, where we use the word substantiated by the employer, is there the opportunity to say certified or...
verified or...
Something that puts a little bit of a burden on the
validated
registrant or the registrant. Not a burden, but an acknowledgement that their statements they're accountable for their statements. And is it necessary? Maybe I'm thinking this one too much.
Well, I think there's some language on the COE form that kind of alludes to that.
I mean, we can say verified instead of substantiated, and then on the COE, we tell them you have to sign, it has to be true and accurate, or otherwise you can be subject to disciplinary action.
So we give them warnings on the COE form.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it's all probably built in.
Yeah, I think verified is a better word.
I do too.
I think verified's good.
Okay.
Look at this. Yeah.
So let me run this scenario real quick since we're here then. An applicant reports, I don't know, 96 months of experience. The registrant recognizes that out of those 96 months, maybe only 72 of them apply. That's probably an extreme number, but for some reason, the registrant isn't comfortable certifying all this time. Is there any opportunity in number four to recognize or address that? I mean, substantiated is one word, verified is another word.
How about substantiated or corrected?
Say that again?
Or, and this isn't quite the right wording, but substantiated or corrected?
Or verified.
Or modified?
Well, here's the thing. If they're indicating they worked more than they really did, and the employer says, no, he didn't work 15 hours, he worked only 10 hours a week for me, that could be a basis to deny an application, because that goes to the truth and veracity of the candidate. Yeah. So, and that might not be something you want to give the applicant an opportunity to correct. You know, because then they'll go, oh, yeah, I miscalculated. I really only worked 10 hours.
Well, and quite honestly, if it was an honest mistake, I mean, I'd probably go to my employee and go,
really?
We've got a discrepancy here. You know, I'm looking at your time records, and you say you work, you know, this much, and I'm only showing this much. How did you come up with this number? And talk to them. You know, but or if it's an employee that I shouldn't be an employee, maybe, you know, I might go, this is wrong. Because we're not, you know, I mean, the whole thing about are they, and it's a question on there that I really struggle with, is this, are they qualified for registration? First of all, we should take it off the exam one, because they're only applying for the exam. They're not qualified for registration.
I agree.
So we probably ought to pull that
out. We need to ditch that question.
Yeah,
that,
I agree.
That question is bogus.
Yeah. Well, we're still working on the applications. So once we're done with the applications, then we'll look at the COEs and all that.
Yeah, so.
I don't know that any of us can solidly identify anything that I'm thinking of. So I don't think there's any need to do anything else.
Okay. Well, I like verified better. The next two rules, for expediency's sake, the time frames internal. We're trying to shorten them, so hopefully the governor's office will be pleased about that. And then architect registration, I'd like you to weigh in on what I did.
I think, you know, right now they changed the name from Intern Development Program to the Architect Experience Program.
Yeah, and they might change the name again next year, so I just put in Professional Training Requirement.
Or NCAR Professional Experience Requirement.
Okay.
Kind of like that better than training.
Okay.
It alludes to the AXP part of it without naming it specifically, because that way, when the next group of concerned individuals comes up and doesn't like the current term, and they have to change it again, we don't have to change our schools.
But they would be right along with Ducey. They want to be called architects without having to take the exam.
Right.
Exactly.
So. And then you'll see I crossed out the 96-month experience anticipation that maybe we'll get to change a statute at some point in the future.
Thank you.
Okay.
Don't tell the engineers.
Yeah, well.
I'm sorry. We're on R-430-214. Page 2139.
I did nothing with the engineer categories rule.
Okay.
Engineer and training, all I did was change in training to fundamentals exam. And distinguish down in C, the designation requires completing the fundamentals exam.
Good.
And I did the same thing with the geology designation in 242. I changed the name of the exam to the fundamentals from the in training, and then distinguished, again, the same way I did with the engineers. The geologist in training designation means you have to pass the fundamentals.
Okay.
And then home inspectors are going to look at this rule 247 next week. These are the changes they wanted. I think they're pretty basic. It's like housekeeping for them. Yeah. They're eliminating grandfather language and names of the accrediting bodies. So I think they'll be pleased with that, and then hopefully you will as well. Landscape architect and training comes out, and I did the same funky thing, Leroy, in Rule 254, landscape architect registration. We had simply said they have to complete the exam, but we forgot all about the experience because we took that out when we eliminated landscape architect in training designation, so I popped it back in. And if you don't like these categories, like Ed didn't like these for the architects, maybe we should revise. But I just picked it out of the one rule and put it in here to make sure that we actually have experience we require landscape architect candidates to have. Because when you eliminated one, it didn't carry forward. So if you want
to
spend some time.
We could relate this back to the CLARB
exam
study that they did.
Yeah, so maybe you and I should meet.
Okay,
meet with Leroy. But I want to make sure we have experience and the exam in here for both.
Right.
And then all the rest are just cross-outs because they're not regulating supervisors and all of that. So I think that those can go away. Patty disagrees, but I think it can. Surveyor and training designation, again, I did what I did with the geologists and the engineers and just renamed the exam the fundamentals and indicated the designation requires passing the fundamentals. And then with the surveyor registration, you have to pass fundamentals and professional exam and then the Arizona State specific. So Jason, did you get a chance to look at Rule 284?
I'm looking at it right now, and I just wonder if there's a way that a way and/or a necessity to synchronize the test, not synchronize, sequentialize the test. Maybe that's the word. So that it's clear that you take the internship test, you take the professional test, then you take the state exam.
We could say must first complete the fundamentals and then secondly complete the cert, you know.
But does that make it...
That would work. I think that's important for us as we see these other professions where they're doing things concurrently. I don't know that works well for us in this testing venue. Maybe someday somebody will invent something that does, but right now I think that would be very helpful if we could go with first, secondly, and thirdly, or however.
But didn't we eliminate that sequential requirement from geologists?
We did.
Yeah.
Is there a reason that they can't take the...
Or that they have to pass one before they can take another? Other.
NCWS may require it.
Maybe we need to look into that a little bit.
Yeah.
I can see waiting to take the state-specific until you've passed both.
Yeah.
That makes sense, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, there is a, if we look back historically, it was the surveyor training or now surveyor intern or fundamentals now. But the test really is geared towards the more... practical end of measuring and measuring land. The professional test starts to get into more of the professional items, which would include maybe some more land law and things like that. So there is truly a progression associated with these tests.
Well, I this is Bill. It seems to me it's like the way I look at the geology is it. If you can pass the test, that means that you have the knowledge that you need to, to serve the public. So, if somebody can pass the state-specific test before they pass the National Council test, then what difference does it make?
Why is it? The state test doesn't test
The principals.
Gosh, you know, if you put all the tests in one bin, 20% of that is state tests, and that pertains only to state laws. It doesn't pertain to the practice.
But you still...
Principles of measurement. Yeah. So, as a good example, right now, Melissa and Patty could go pass the state test. With their legal training, they probably could pass the state portion of that test because it's geared around state laws. So familiarization with the state laws is just one part of the overall component.
Right, right. I'm not suggesting that you pass the state law exam and then that's all you have to do. I'm just saying that it doesn't. You don't have to wait to take it in some sort of sequence.
NCWS may require, they may not grant access to their professional exam without first passing their fundamentals.
That's interesting. You know, you really got me thinking, you know, I mean, why would a surveyor, I need to think about that a lot. That's a good question.
And while you're thinking about that, be thinking about the examination for surveying Mars.
It's going to be done with a rover.
Oh, my God.
Specific.
All right.
Exam.
I know you guys are weary. Do you want to just push the rest of this off to another meeting?
He's only got 3 minutes to get out.
I know.
Yeah. Well, there's going to be another shot at this.
Maybe we should schedule another meeting for like a month and a half out or something.
Yeah, or a month.
Month out, just so we can keep moving on.
Keep moving.
There's a lot of stuff. A lot of these pages, though, actually, we're pretty much there. I'm just...
Well, 301, professional, I don't know if you guys want to change anything on the rules of professional conduct. The only one I changed, really, was 5. Shall not violate any federal criminal state or federal criminal statute, and I took out the list because that's always really limiting.
Yeah.
And then the surveyors wanted the Apple's address, something about Apple's.
Oh, yeah, that's got to go. That's somebody's personal address that isn't with APLS anymore. Yeah.
Oh, so that needs to go away is what needs to be struck from there.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think their website is probably enough identifying information there.
Okay, and then what about the date, Jason, of the standards, minimum standards? We have June 2001. Are we still using those, or are we going with a...
We are still using those. The APLS adopted some standards at some point that were different in hopes of bringing them probably to this table right now. So I think it would be beneficial to contact the professional... associations, both of them in the state, and see what their feelings are, if this is the time to change that language. Personally, if anybody cares about my personal thought, I think we're fine with the old ones.
Okay.
And if you're going to ask me what do we do, I'm going to say leave it alone, don't call anybody, but that's not fair to
right.
the profession, and I want to be representative of them.
Okay, that's fair. And again, the home inspectors are going to look at their rules. Seals. The only change I made was to change registered landscape architect to professional landscape architect. And I have no idea if the use of seals is current and correct. So, again, deferring to those of you who do use.
Does 305 come out once the drug...
Yes. That will be a day I dance and sing, which is...
Will you sell tickets for that?
You don't want to see it, Ben. I could. It would be very funny.
You know, Melissa, backing up the seals, I don't know if we have a pending investigation on the use of seals and land surveying electronic. I don't know if it's an issue or not. There might be something we need to asterisk there and look into, I guess.
Okay. You guys still like the idea? Patty was concerned that we make people sign and date beneath their seal, and that the seals themselves are dated.
The expiration date?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know what? That causes a lot of confusion. Mm-hmm. I've had jurisdictions try to require me to resubmit drawings after my seal expired because they think it expired.
So, and you guys have to buy new seals every three years, right?
No.
No?
They can change.
The smart ones, you just set, like mine says September 30th in a blank, and I handwrite it in, or 90% of mine are electronic seals,
okay.
And so it just gets updated every year. But it's, to me, the only thing it does is help me remember.
Yeah.
Which was why it was done.
Why it was done.
Yeah, why it was done. Right. We're sending out notices again.
We are.
Reminders. And I'm sorry, we are big kids, and if we can't remember to renew our registration, I got 7 of them to keep track of.
That's a...
And no other state requires me to put an expiration date on my seal.
Okay.
I say get rid of it.
I personally don't like the tentative message it sends to clients, especially out-of-state people. We do an office survey or something like that. Like Ed said, you get lawyers looking at this stuff, and they don't think it's good.
Yeah, they think
after
the drawings
the date
expired.
Of your expiration.
You know, they think it's a can of beans.
They think the drawings have expired?
Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like a carton of milk, you know. Hey, your drawing's stale.
Okay. I will strike it, and then you guys can pick up the argument with your engineer colleagues who like it.
Not a problem. We're used to that.
I know. Okay. Cool.
And I found filibustering the chairman, the current chairman, is really an effective tactic.
That's what will have to happen.
Very brief.
All right, so we'll propose taking it out, and then...
Can we take up Neil's next time?
Yes, we certainly can.
Take
and you knew it was Neil's,
take up
huh?
Neil's question about shop drawings, stamping shop drawings.
The patty cakes, I think. Kind
the of patty
yeah.
cakes, yeah.
I know.
And Neil spelled N-E-E-L.
Well,
K-N-E-E-L.
You should see what I get from it.
Oh,
so.
Gosh.
Yeah, I know.
I'm not sure I want to.
We've told him to stop that crap, but he doesn't listen, so.
He's not trainable. Where's the expiration date on here?
It was subsection E.
Number 33, the very last thing. Appendix B.
Yeah, so we would propose removing. And it's also... God, 305 is such a pain. Also, on page 26, E, what's the rule number? E has E4, a notation between the seal, either written, typed, or electronically generated, providing the day, month, and year of the expiration of the current registration would have to be struck on 304E4. So that, and then on the very last page. Cool. Thank you, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. When do you want to meet?
When are the home inspectors meeting?
They're meeting on the 17th, next Tuesday.
So
I'm opening my calendar. I have to be in D.C. for a Prudential Alternative Review Team meeting.
Ooh.
It's my new committee assignment.
Ooh.
It's the successor to BEA.
Yeah. That's a really long agenda, or a really long title.
CART.
For your new... Oh, CART.
The CART.
You're on the CART
I'm
committee.
I'm on the CART.
Cool. So we'll push Neil's item, K-N-E-E-L, Neil's item, off to number 6. Future agenda items, and the rules again, rules review, and by your next meeting, I don't know, do you want to consider legislation? It may not be timely, the best thing, because the board will probably see the legislation before the committee.
Yeah. You know, you want it on the agenda, and then if there's nothing...
Just in case.
At least you can talk about it.
Okay. Bless you. Legislation to discuss.
So our board meeting's the 24th.
Yep. Yeah. So do you want a meeting in February?
Let me grab it.
Maybe we could do the 21st.
What's our meeting in February?
28th, the last day of the month.
Okay. The Tuesday before?
Mm-hmm. The 21st.
That would work.
How about the 21st at 9 o'clock?
February?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it'll work.
When, on bills that are introduced, what days do those usually come up for hearings?
It depends on which committee they're assigned to. So ours could go to either the Commerce Committee or Government or Workforce, whatever they decide. They strategize that too, knowing, you know, it has to pass through at least one committee in each house. So it just depends when those committees meet. So the only day they don't meet is Friday. So, yeah. Are you doing the Westcar phone call? Yeah.
I'm way back from Prescott.
Oh, you're going to Prescott.
I'm going to Prescott Valley right now. I'm supposed to be there at 1, but obviously I'm going to be late.
Yeah.
I'll just call the client and let them know.
I thought the phone call was late.
2 o'clock.
Oh, it's at... No, I think it's East Coast? Or is it...
It's West Coast. So it's 3 o'clock West Coast time, 2 o'clock our time.
Oh, it is.
Or no, 1 o'clock West Coast time, 2 o'clock our time.
Really?
I think.
Because I have it at noon.
You have it at noon?
Yeah. Because if it was 1 o'clock their time, it's 12 o'clock our time, right?
Let's wait a minute here.
California's an hour behind us.
Right.
And notice the Cordis Junction.
Mine came in at 2 o'clock. Yeah.
That was Paolo Solari's last project.
Oh, was it?
We had that design on Cordis Junction. Was done by
oh, the
Paolo Solari.
Arco Sante itself, or the...
No. The, on the bridges across I-15. I-15.
1 o'clock Pacific time.
I-17.
That's 2 o'clock our time.
2 o'clock our time.
Okay. You can see I'm time zone challenged. I have serious trouble.
All right.
2 o'clock our time. Okay. Well, that's good. Then I can actually have lunch.
And I had to jump off at 2:30 because I got a client call at 2:30.
Are we adjourned?
Oh, yeah, let's do that. Let's move for adjournment.
Move for adjournment.
Second.
Okay.
Second.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Aye, aye. Thank you, Kurt, for keeping us on track.